Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. Recently, I started getting some people asking me to rather come up with solutions rather than just mentioning problems or discussing history or discussing other lessons that can be learned from history. So I'm very happy to hear that there are people who want solutions and who are thinking about how an individual can do something with your life that is useful for your race. And in this regard, I think that if we can ever create a culture among ourselves that every day of your life, that you spend even 15 minutes of every day that you can put aside and do something that is good for our race, that is going to really help us a lot. If you can make it almost a religious requirement that at least 15 or 30 minutes of every day will be set aside to do something positive for whites as a group, regardless of what it is, even if it is just talking to someone, lifting their spirits, helping them, or reposting information from some group to somebody else, or chatting to someone. But if you can spend every day allocating a little bit of your time for free to your people, then that can become a huge thing. And you mustn't see these times and these problems as being insurmountable and life-threatening. We in South Africa are living in the most dangerous situation of all, and we should actually view ourselves as what we were not too long ago, barely a century ago. We should view ourselves as pioneers. We are yet again in the forefront of the battle for our race. Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, the Prime Minister of South Africa, said in the 1950s, he said that South Africa is on the front line of the battle for the white man. And that hasn't changed. And what has changed is that a lot of the problems of the white South African, almost all the problems of the white South African, have now become problems in America and Europe. So the fight here against other races is even more important than it ever was. And, interestingly enough, through our actions in the past, we actually gained a heck of a lot of experience in this, which whites in Europe and America don't have. So as few as we are sitting in the situation that we're sitting in, we actually have all kinds of potential that is untapped. But there's much more that I'll return to about the whites in Africa and what the whites in Africa could do and the potential they have. All I will say is that South Africa must not be given up. South Africa must not be abandoned by the whites of South Africa. Our goal must be to see to it that at all costs, South Africa remains within the sphere of the Western world. There are tremendous riches and potential sitting here in South Africa that even the whites of South Africa don't know and don't notice. Our lessons and our struggles with the blacks in Africa is something that can now be applied and taught to whites all across the world. And there are many things that we in Southern Africa have faced where we are unique among our race in facing these problems. And the lessons of what we did is going to be extremely valuable to the rest of our race. We must therefore view ourselves as pioneers. We are sitting in a situation that none of us wanted to be in, but that is the nature of life. We must do what whites have done all throughout the ages, and that is face all kinds of unknowns and ask ourselves questions about what can we do as individuals, what can we do as groups, how can we face these problems. The biggest problem that the white right faces everywhere that I've noticed is fear. The number one problem that the white right faces is fear and also demoralization. Our enemies are constantly trying to scare us and to put fear in our ranks. Constantly, it never stops. Newspaper articles have been run in South Africa talking about how whites are going to be put in jail for running groups on phones. So the two biggest things that I see everywhere that holds up whites is fear and demoralization. And then from that comes bad conclusions where whites then think that as a group that we are doomed and we cannot move forward. I would argue that probably the greatest tactics used against us are fear and demoralization. The fear comes in many forms. It comes in fear for one's life initially, but it also comes in fear of losing your job, fear of losing your income, fear of being shunned by your community. The threats that whites in America face versus the threats that whites in South Africa face are somewhat different. And then the whites of Europe have even more different problems. So whites in different places have got different things that are happening to them and different problems that they face. So among the questions that someone asked me was, they were saying, well, you're talking about guns and getting weapons and stuff, but we aren't in that position, and even if we get stuff, we won't be able to use it. Can't you come up with something that we can do? And in his case, he was talking about possibility of discussing things like marriage and children and the problems that men and women are having with each other. So that is a topic that I've also dug into quite a bit and done a lot of thinking about, but I've never discussed it ever, except for maybe the odd posting on one of my websites. And so I welcome the fact that somebody wants to listen to possible ways of approaching problems. And that is what I'm going to be doing. I will come back and touch on problems like that. I will do some things where I'm going to put out some new thoughts, and I'll show you some of the thoughts that I have about how we can approach things. I'm a big believer in radicalism. By radicalism, I mean take things that we're doing, throw the entire thing out the window, start all over again, do something brand new, and do something that has as its aim big success. Big success. Instant success. Quick success. There are ways of tackling all kinds of problems, but you've got to think like a radical. I'm not a big believer in incremental solutions to problems. Incremental solutions, small changes that give minor benefits, doesn't work for me. I'm a big believer in total radicalism, meaning you throw everything out the window. You say, what is the problem? We need a solution, and the solution must deliver big results fast. And that is what I'm trying to get into people's minds, is to start thinking like a radical. Think radical. Think quick wins, big wins. We want to go for overwhelming victory. But how are you going to do it if you're just one person? So that is where I'm also going to talk about some other things. But it's good to see that there are people who are willing to think about changing their behavior and actually doing something in the real world. That is excellent. Now, if we can get more and more whites to do things in the real world, then we're going to start rocking and rolling. And that's where this video is going to be a starting point, because we're going to start with something simple. Another good thing that I've observed generally is that the attention span of whites has increased massively. In the beginning, when I was on YouTube, people were saying do 5-minute videos, 10-minute videos, and I experimented with that. But I've noticed that in recent times, people are now longing for information, and they are longing for deeper information, thoughts that they can really soak up and start processing. In fact, somebody even sent me a message a time back where they said how much they enjoy long videos. The guy was saying, oh, you know, a 3-hour video is like nothing, you know, that's great. You know, send in the long videos. And that is excellent, because people are starting to suck up knowledge and start processing it in depth, and that is important. I try as much as possible to put relevant information and detailed information into my videos so that people can have additional thoughts and that they can understand context and depth. I'm not a great believer in just simplification. I believe that in order for whites to do things properly, they need to understand things in detail. And that is what I'm also going to be discussing here, is what makes us function, what makes us win, what has made us win in the past, and why it should be used right now. And also, what has made some of the nations and tribes inside our race the most effective in their time. And you will see same things coming out again and again. Even in modern times, old lessons are still valid. And if you adopt a certain way of approaching things, you will see what is possible. And it's very important that every white person understands that you have potential. You can do a lot. When I worked at the bank, there was a young white Afrikaans guy. His name was Franz. And Franz was alone in a department of technical people. And he was surrounded by blacks and Indians. And they were constantly beating down on Franz. Then at a point, due to a project I was on, I was beginning to look for somebody who would do things for me quickly and get things done. And there was a whole lot of negative talk about this white guy, Franz. But I was checking Franz out, and I was thinking to myself that this guy might have potential. I don't trust these others. I don't think that they're that capable. So I began to put some focus on chatting to Franz. And I lifted up his spirits and I began to teach him things. And he began to learn. And after many months, Franz became my go-to guy in that team. Anytime I wanted anything, Franz would jump up and do it for me and come back and he'd say, "Done, and I did this and this and this." And I also started telling Franz, "What you must do is, don't just do the things that I told you. Also go and start thinking for yourself. And if you see a problem coming along, don't even ask me. Go and solve that problem yourself immediately." And you know what? Franz used to do that. Then he'd come back to me and he'd say to me, and he'd give me all the technical details. So I know that he's not making stuff up. And he'd say to me, "You know what, Jan, I was doing this and then I saw that. And do you know, I got that warning message over there and then somebody told me about this thing and I decided I must do this immediately and I just went. I wasn't supposed to do it." He'd even break the rules, which I liked. He'd even break the rules and he'd say to me, "You know what, Jan, I went and I did this and I did that, and you know, I normally have to fill in these forms and I have to ask for permission. I didn't do any of that. I just went and did it. And there was a certain amount of risk involved. I had to take these backups and I had to do that and I had to do it quickly because people would notice, etc." And he'd come back and he'd say, "I did this and this and this and this and this, and it's all done and it's working." And I'd say, "Wow, that was fucking awesome." And I loved that. And Franz enjoyed it and he enjoyed working with me. And we were just getting more and more productive. And I could give him simpler and simpler orders and he'd just get more stuff done. And then he'd come back and he'd be happy. And he'd enjoy doing stuff for me more than he enjoyed his normal work. And later on, Franz, who'd been so beaten up by all these non-whites and other fucking pieces of shit, including his bosses, including, I must tell you, a white woman from Zimbabwe. In other words, she was a ex-Rhodesian, but a younger generation ex-Rhodesian. One of the ones that are totally bent and broken, and they do everything for blacks. His boss, his departmental boss, was this white Zimbabwean bitch. And I learned to detest that fucking woman. And she also was looking for ways to destroy him and to get him out of the whole team. The fucking bitch. And in the corporate world, I came across quite a few of these white women. White Afrikaans women as well. Also busy working for the blacks, doing everything for them, looking after them and hammering the whites, kicking whites to the side like dogs. White women can be among the worst traitors, especially when they start moving up the ranks. Truly, they can be scum. And I hated this white Zimbabwean woman. She comes from the same country I come from. She disgusted me. I hated her. And she deliberately tried to destroy France. But France survived, and he survived for quite a long time. Eventually, after some years, they worked him out, and they also then worked me out. So we all got our turn, and eventually all of us were destroyed. But during that time, once Franz regained his self-confidence and he began to feel more confident as a human being, France would then sometimes look at all these non-whites around him, and then he would say the following. He'd do something and he'd pull off some feat, which now makes them look not that good, and they weren't good to begin with. And now he's got a bit of morale and he's got a bit of confidence in himself and he's feeling happy. And then France would look at them all and he'd say to them, "Not bad for a white guy, hey?" So he's so used to being beat up on as a white guy that now that he's got self-confidence, he'll look at them and he'll look at them mockingly and he'll say to them, "Not bad for a white guy, hey? You thought that I was a loser kind of a thing, and look at what I did." And that's the kind of attitude you should have. And that's the kind of attitude that we all need to have. We need to get into that. Just to tell you the end of the story of France, once they chased France out, France decided to try and leave South Africa and get himself a job in another country. He managed to get a job in New Zealand, and he ended up in New Zealand, and he's been there ever since. And from what I could see, he was doing well. So he eventually got away from all these non-whites and blacks and white women who'll beat up on him, make his life a fucking misery, and fuck him around for the rest of his life. And he actually went and now he lives a more decent life in another country. But that is the kind of thing that we all need to get to, is we need to have that personal pride, personal confidence. And once you've got that personal pride, personal confidence in yourself, many things are possible. So part of our task is to also uplift other whites while we're doing things. Lift up other whites. Make them feel better. Start helping them to help themselves. And in that way, we'll all start developing the kind of group values and group trust and team spirit that's going to make us become an awesome team. We've got to become an awesome team, and all of us are capable of it in all countries. We're white people. We have a history of success. We've got a history of facing danger and disaster. We can overcome anything. There is nothing that they can throw at us that our ancestors haven't experienced 1,000 times or 10,000 times harder and worse. The problems and threats that we face are minor. Another thing that another young guy had asked me last year was he was interested in the idea of a concept that came from the American who founded the American Nazi Party, the late great George Lincoln Rockwell, who was killed. They killed him because this guy was dangerous and effective. He managed to get a lot done with almost nothing. So George Lincoln Rockwell, at a point, because he had a military background, he'd been a pilot and he'd fought in World War II and in the Korean War. George Lincoln Rockwell spoke about the need to create a balanced political army. And this young American wanted to know about what kind of political army can we create that can function. And so in this case, with this activism, I want to talk also about how this activism leads to what one can call a political army. This is a key tool. So we're going to be discussing activism and how to do it individually, but all of this leads to the beginnings of what you can call a political army. The concept of a political army has been around a lot. Even the CIA has been using it. The CIA has been using it for decades. It's been around. Blacks have used it. Everybody's using it. Whites are the only people who are not using it. So a political army is an important thing. In many respects, all the white activism that is already taking place, all the groups that have been formed, without realizing it, people don't realize that they're already acting partly like a political army already. Except that we need to ramp these things up and make these things even more professional, more effective, more powerful, and then you're going to see what's possible. I'm totally convinced that the black and Jewish house of cards is not as strong as you think, and that it can be broken easier than you think, and that all kinds of things are possible. I think that there are many people who think that when I talk and I talk about great possibilities for the future, they imagine that I'm just a dreamer. I just dream all kinds of stuff and I don't even know whether it's possible. I just talk big things because I like to talk big things. What they don't realize is that I'm sitting and I'm watching and I've been at this for quite a time and I look at things that are possible. If only we could get enough people to put enough energy into it. If only we can get people who will stick together. If only we can get people who will act with the highest integrity and professionalism, that the best can be brought out of us, that the best can be pulled out of each person so that each white is as effective as he can be. I particularly like the American Army's recruiting posters. They've always had a recruiting system that says, "Join the army, be all that you can be." Of course, in reality, it is, "Be all that you can be so that you can kill the enemies of the Jews." So that you can go and kill Israel's enemies. Be all that you can be for the Jews. But I'd like you to think in terms of be all that you can be as a white person, that when you are working for your race and with your race, that all of us must strive to be all that we can be. We don't strive downwards, we strive upwards. We always have, and we're going to do things we've never done before. So don't be afraid of the unknown. Don't be afraid of the situation that you're in. And so what I will do is I will draw a distinction between what whites in different countries and areas can do. I see there being three regions. There's North America that functions in its own way. Then there is Europe and maybe even New Zealand that functions in another way. And then there's South Africa. And each region has got its pluses and minuses. So we're going to set out to be all that we can be. And by the way, about people with short attention spans, people who are quick to change their minds, etc. I never concern myself with people with short attention spans. My view has been that there are people who, if they have short attention spans and they lack courage and they lack any kind of determination, those people anyway aren't going to amount to much. So I don't want those people around anyway. In South Africa and Afrikaans, there's a lovely term, and I can't think of an English equivalent at this point, but the term is "Hy wip sy gat." And what it basically means, it's almost like somebody turns around and in a very quick way turns his back on you. It's almost like the person's turning his back on you immediately. You say something in a wip sy gat. You say something and the person just turns around and he distances himself from you, turns his back on you, and he walks out. Now, I've noticed that there are a lot of people who in South Africa operate like that. And some of them might be Christians, they could be all kinds of people, and they have this thing of they'll just quickly turn their back on you and distance themselves from you as if their rejection of you is going to change you. Well, that might work with people who are of a commercial mindset, but I'm not of a commercial mindset, so I don't care. And those kinds of people, I watch some of those people come into my groups. They come and they leave and they come and go and they do whatever they do. And those who I see leaving, I just say to myself, "Jy kan jou gat wip. You can turn your back on me and distance yourself from me as much as you want. I don't care. I don't care. And I don't want to work with people who aren't serious people." But luckily, a lot of the younger people are getting more serious and they are wanting to do things. And so we will sit and we'll discuss various things that are possible. And also, what technology and modern methods allow and don't allow, what is possible. The third thing that people have been doing that's very wrong is that, and I've noticed this especially among people in the white right in America who have become very demoralized, And also with some people in South Africa, especially older people, where people have decided to abandon technology. They've decided that technology is not good, that a thing like a cell phone, you must stay away from a mobile phone. That is wrong. That is wrong. In fact, in the last 20 years of my own activism, I have focused on the notion that the internet is the only way that I can spread my message to other people. The internet is the only way that I can communicate with other people. And in activism, this is a very important point here. How am I going to reach people in other countries? Well, the internet is the main tool. So right from the beginning, armed with just a PC, I focused on how am I going to get a message to people outside the country and what can I send them? What can I send them? Can I send them text? Then later I began to look at can I show them photos, and much later I began to look at videos. And the first time I looked at videos, videos were not of any use at all because the problem with videos was that I didn't have the bandwidth. But now, nowadays, it's very, very easy. I did proper tests in about 2009 on videos. And I found that for my purposes, YouTube and videos were totally worthless in 2009. When I went back to the same thing in 2015, I saw that no, YouTube can work now. Bandwidths have increased, lots of things are better, operating systems are better, there's more that you can do. So technology itself changes and lots of good things are coming. But now, people are also afraid, and you've got lots of whites who are afraid of technology, including very clever people. Very clever people are afraid of technology. People who are brilliant, people who should be using technology, are afraid of technology. And I've noticed, especially even with donations, I eventually managed to track down and find out what it was that was my problem. And I discovered fear. Fear and technology were the things that were really holding me back. That fear is the biggest thing that's holding us back. But combined with it is a fear of technology. The notion that blacks have got computers, blacks can spy on you, Jews can spy on you. Now that is being used as a thing that scares whites. Whites are becoming afraid to talk to other whites because they fear the spies. They fear the things that are going to be found out about them. For me, in the last 20 years, I've used technology time and again and experimented with it, especially from my software point of view, to see what is possible, what can be done. And I began to experiment with things that I could do, but I've also been watching what others can do and what is being made available by whites generally. There are tons and tons of things that are out there that you don't even know about, that have already been invented, that are just waiting for a use. And whites are not even using things that other whites have already invented and put in place. There is so much. In the world of computers and technology, whites have gone and done amazing things, the vast amount of which is totally unappreciated, hardly noticed, nobody even looks at it, nobody even uses it. We are in a technical war and it's a communications war. In this war, it is about them wanting to stop white people communicating. It is my view that the key thing that the South African government wants, that the African National Congress wants, that Jews in South Africa want, that Jews in the world want, is they all want white people to stop talking to each other. They want to stop us talking to each other. They need to shut us down. And many other whites have noticed this. We are therefore in a technical war. This is not a shooting war, it's a technical war. The closest that I can draw a parallel to is the war in World War II, the war on radio and on signals and with radar. So, for example, the idea is intercepting other radio signals, decrypting them, reading them, and it's a war, an ongoing war as to who is able to keep secrecy and who can't, who can listen in on whom, and so on. So it's a constant battle, a technical battle. And the internet phones, laptops. This is a full-on technical war. There are people trying to hide things. There are people trying to spy on things. It's a constant battle. And in this battle, there are technical specialists involved, but there are also old, tried and tested methods. Send in infiltrators. Send in spies. Let the spies go and see what the others are talking about. Let the spies go and listen. So you've got electronic eavesdropping on the one hand, and you've got spies and traitors in your midst who are trying to stir up trouble or trying to see who is doing what and how can we destroy this. So understand that you're in a technical war, and this war will not end. But if I look at what's been achieved on the internet over the last 20 years, whites have been able to fight back against billionaires, etc. Another point is, who is trying to censor us the most? Well, you will see that there are people who've landed in jail, and all the whites who've landed in jail mostly have done something that is illegal. You do get some like Matt Hale who've been set up and put in jail even though they didn't actually commit a crime. So one enters a shady world where you could be set up, I could be set up, I might end up like Matt Hale. The same could happen to you. So these are among the risks that we face. And risk is another thing that we face and have to deal with. So there are two sides to this technical battle. The one is technology itself, and the other one is the old, old game of spies and infiltration. So even if they can't crack our codes, and even if they can't listen in on all our discussions in real time, they might just resort to, and I'm convinced they do, they resort to sending large numbers of whites into our groups, Jews and whites, who come in and infiltrate, and they sit and they watch. And they see who can be set up, who's going to do something, who should be destroyed, who is dangerous. So yes, the internet, our websites, the social media, our phones, these things are hotbeds for spies. Government spies, but also business and Jews. Now the governments, as I will discuss later, there are differences between the way governments operate and the way businesses operate. You must distinguish between these two things. This is very important. I did not know about these distinctions until I got into activism. So a final point about technology and tools. You need to look at all these technical things that we have, and you must see them for what they are. If you look at the history of our race, you will see that all through our history, all major achievements were done on the back of tools. We invented tools or obtained tools or perfected tools, and then these tools became very useful. In fact, in the terms of Professor Carol Quigley, who we will return to, a lot of our tools turned into what you could call instruments of expansion. This is a very important term from Professor Quigley. Instruments of expansion. Instruments of expansion are civilization-level instruments, and the term instrument doesn't mean that it's a physical thing. An instrument can be nothing more than an organization of whites, and it can be an organization of whites using a specific set of physical tools, and then there is tactics. So tactics becomes how you use your tools. The use of your tool and how you use your tool becomes an area of thinking. So there are basically a couple of related concepts that I just want to repeat. The one is a physical tool that can achieve something that you couldn't do before. The physical tool could be a sword. The physical tool could be a machine gun. The physical tool could be a horse. The physical tool could be a car. But the physical tool can also be a radio. The physical tool, oh, and by the way, radio. Radio is still possible and possibly useful even in this day and age. So radio, internet, your phone, your laptop, your computer, these are tools. These are physical tools that allow you to do something you couldn't do before. So there's the physical tool and what the tool can do. Now in an army, The first thing you will want to do is you'll want to be able to take your rifle as your physical tool, and you will go and you will do target practice because you want to use your rifle efficiently. Now, that applies to our computer tools as well. Our tools, these computers and phones, and I will refer to a phone as a computer because it is a computer. It has an operating system. In fact, it's a very specialized type of computer. It's a type of computer that is compact, and this computer also has special sensors that other computers don't have. So it can tell when you are moving it. It can tell its location. It can even tell its angle. If you turn it around and you flip it around, it even knows what is up and what is down. So it's a very specialized computer. Thus, the first thing to understand is you've got a tool. The next thing you want to do is to use your tool professionally to the maximum of what it can do. Because that is how you approach actual warfare. That is how you approach actual life. If you are the driver of a vehicle, if you are working with a crane or a front-end loader, or you're driving a tractor, or you're driving a truck, or you're working a certain kind of a machine, you will want to know how to use your tool to the maximum effect. If you are a carpenter, if you're doing carpentry, or you're doing welding, you will be spending a lot of time on what can this tool do and how do I do it effectively? What can the tool do by itself, and what techniques can I use with this tool that will make it even more effective? I have a knife in my hand, but I can use a knife in different ways. And these are the kinds of thoughts that go into it. How can I use that tool more effectively? And it turns out that when it comes to these lovely, simple-looking devices, these phones and these computers, they've actually got a whole lot more potential for clever use than almost any other tool you will find. That a phone is not just a thing that you just touch here and touch there. A phone can do myriads of things. A phone is a full-on sophisticated computer. A phone is even more sophisticated than your desktop PC. Your phone is a very, very sophisticated computer. What can you use that phone for? White people are not even tapping into a fraction of a percentage of what these tools are capable of. Furthermore, there are tools that have already been invented, that are already being used, that you don't even know about, that themselves have tremendous potential. There are all kinds of electronic devices now that are also programmable, that also have other features, that also have other sensors. Let me tell you, in this world that we are in, the ability to use technology and technical things for our survival, for our protection, for our physical ability to defend ourselves, as well as our politics and our culture, the amount of stuff that is available is beyond imagination. We are hardly even tapping into even 5% of what is possible. We are not even looking at the kinds of things that are possible. We are walking around with notebooks and laptops and phones, and we are not even tapping into a fraction of what these tools can do. You can spend months and even years studying certain aspects of these tools because they are so sophisticated, and you'd be able to find out you can do this, you can do that. So if you're a welder, you will want to know, how do you use your welding machine to the maximum effectiveness? How can you do it fast? How can you do it efficiently? How can you weld the strongest joint? How do you weld this kind of thing? How do you weld that kind of thing? That is how you would think if you're working with a welding machine. If you're a carpenter, you will say, I've got a drill, I've got a saw, I've got this kind of saw, I've got that kind of saw. And you'll be saying, how do I make these things work together? Let me tell you, in the world of the internet, phones, computers, technical devices, this is a vast, vast area that we can tap into. And there are lots of tools hidden away in there that we can all use. Not only that, but the methods of learning have improved. You've got videos sitting on the internet, videos, articles on how do you solve this problem, how do you solve that problem. You can actually go and teach yourself very quickly using the internet. Furthermore, if you can't get a specific solution, then there are people who can help you. And in my regard, I'm happy to guide people as well on things that they might not be aware that their tools can do. So when you are sitting with, firstly, the physical tool, then the next thing is the technique of using that tool. What can you do with it? With a phone, you can use certain chat mechanisms. You can talk to individual people. But then you also have the internet itself. You've got websites. Then you've also got email. Everybody has forgotten about email. Email exists. Now you need to look at these tools and say, what can we do? What is the maximum that we can do with these things? Then the next thing that one can do that also comes from white history is you've got your physical tool. You now know how to use your physical tool very well. Your next thing is the area of tactics. What are the tactical methods of using that tool? Here we start entering into an interesting world where the Jews are way ahead of us when it comes to communication. Jews already have advanced techniques of using communication for their benefit, and they've used it across the world, and they've used it to tie up entire nations. We now have to quickly catch up and learn the techniques that go with these tools. So you've got tactics that you can use as an individual. If you are a soldier or if you are a carpenter, you will know, I can use my rifle in this and this and this way. I can use my hand grenade in that and that way. If I have a drill or a certain type of saw, you know, this is the best use for this. That's how I can achieve that. But even as a carpenter, you'll also have like a plan B. You'll know that if I can't do it this way, I can use that method as a backup. I'll still be able to achieve something. A soldier knows if I can't do this, I'll be able to work out that as my next best mechanism. All of these lessons are equally applicable to the world of the internet and to the tools of the internet. If they send spies and infiltrators to work against you, then there are techniques you can use as well. And you can have your own tactics. If they block you in this way, what can you do to work around it? Many of the people, even the older people, who stuck it out on the social media and on email, eventually discovered that if they are blocked here, they can do that. They're already starting to learn the basics of using their tools better. And one thing I want to urge you is don't run away from the internet. Don't run away from websites. Don't run away from phones. Don't run away from communications methods. Don't abandon technology. In fact, turn around and start learning about technology and make some time to teach yourself technology. And if you're stuck, ask people questions. If you run into problems, ask people questions. I have spent a lot of time in my internet wars where I've had technical battles where they come and they hack my websites, they try and fuck things up for me, they try and do this to me, they try and do that to me. And I actually take the time to go and spend the hours and days as is necessary to sit and to study what has happened to me and to try and solve it and to try and find ways around it. Over the years, I've learned all kinds of things. I've developed methods of my own. Then later on I discover, you know what, I don't even need to use my methods anymore. There's something new out there that's even better. Then I learn to use that. There is a hell of a lot going on, and you can use your intelligence and your personal judgment, and it will allow you to move into the world of excellence. I cannot emphasize enough also that as part of our racial tradition that we take risks and we use our minds. I cannot impress enough upon you that you too must learn the art of risk-taking and the art of using your mind. Observe, analyze, think, develop counter-tactics to tactics that are used against you. Develop your own tactics. All of these things are very useful. And as we become more sophisticated, I'm totally convinced that right now, white people are leading the charge in the world in the use of the internet. And the white right has especially focused on the internet. Adolf Hitler himself used radio and TV which were brand new things in his time to mass communicate in his time, and it was very effective. He made use of radio and TV to the maximum. The internet is a tool that must be used by whites to the maximum. Don't run away from anything technical. Don't be afraid of technical things. We need to find answers. We need to learn tactics. You need to experiment with things. Somebody must go and try something and come back and say, yes, that thing is safe. We can use that thing. These are among the things that I do quietly with people that I trust. We also share information and we talk about things where we were beaten or knocked out or harmed in some way, and then we look at ways that people found that worked around it. And as time goes by and you share knowledge and experience, the rate at which we can counter their moves can increase. In terms of being dynamic and moving faster than them, this is very possible and it's very easy. But what you've got to do is you've got to get away from fear and you've got to get away from the notion that technical things are dangerous things. The biggest thing that concerns people are spies. People are concerned about spies. Well, in my case, I don't care about spies because, firstly, I'm not doing anything illegal. I'm not stealing from anybody. I'm not busy building a bomb, and I have no plans immediately to kill anybody. So I'm doing everything that is legal and that I'm allowed to do. I'm allowed to have my free speech, and I insist on my free speech. In fact, for me, my tools are my primary tool for engaging in free speech when I'm not allowed to engage in free speech. And that is what you should also be using these tools for. Our enemies do not even want us to sit and talk to each other and to form bonds with each other and to be happy with each other. They don't want that. They do not want us to build up a team spirit. They do not want us to get closer together. They fear that if we do, that we are going to do bigger things. And indeed, that is what we should be aiming for, is for the bigger things that we can do once we are a close-knit team and we are more capable. So regard the internet and regard these things as tools and use your tools, get to know your tools. You would know that if you have a welding machine, you can do this, but you can't do that. You know with your rifle, hey, I must look after it by doing this, I must do that. This is how you must look at these things. Look at everything as a tool, and this tool for communication is the most important tool. These tools for communication are the most important tools for racial survival, physical survival, prevention of crime, combating of crime, and allowing us to have free speech, allowing us to organize our politics, allowing us to assist each other and communicate globally. These tools are so critically important to us. If we lose the battle of the internet and technology, we will be destroyed. We will be destroyed. We will die. We will be destroyed. We will be finished. That is how important it is. Everything that we've achieved in the last 20, 25 years has been as a direct result of the internet. It's a major tool, and it's a tool that we've used very effectively. We've also used this tool. It comes at a low cost and a low price. This tool comes with tremendous efficiency benefits. It comes at very, very low cost. And this allows us to engage in asymmetrical warfare. How many times have you heard of the mighty Chinese using asymmetrical warfare against America? Well, guess what? White people, especially the white right, is the greatest and most successful group of people when it comes to asymmetrical warfare. We are able to fight against billionaires. We're able to fight against big corporations. We're able to fight against governments. And we are doing it with tools that have got very low cost, and we don't even have a fraction of the capital that others have. We don't even have 1/10,000th of the capital of our enemies, and we are whipping their asses. Imagine if we got more organized and we had an even healthier approach. So the third thing being using your tool and the tactics for it as an individual. That is the third level. The fourth level is when you start gathering people in groups and you start forming armies or units of, quotes, armies. And this can be political armies, activism armies. If you start gathering people together and you start saying, okay, you do this, and Fred over there and Joe over there, they're going to do that, and the rest of us are going to do this. And we're going to go in with group tactics. So, to summarize, the four levels, you've got a physical instrument that allows you to do something you've never been allowed to do before. Secondly, you learn how to use this instrument in all its fine detail to the maximum. Thirdly, you start developing the tactics. You know that this instrument can send email, you know that it can do this, you know that it can do that. But now you want to say, how can I do it faster and quicker? And then you start developing tactical methods of using that instrument. You know how to shoot, but can you shoot in this way? Can you, as a carpenter, make a join in that way? That's your third level, the tactics of using that instrument. And the fourth level is when you get groups, and now you start using groups and group tactics. Now you have a much more sophisticated thing. We know that this person's got access to this, that one's got access to that, and we now work out a group tactic. And this is where we could go in with political warfare, especially. And that is what somebody in South Africa was asking me about activism. Can we do something about farm murders? And he made some very specific suggestions, which I'm still going to read to you. But here is where he's starting to think about tactics and group tactics. He's already thinking about the fourth level. And yes, now we're starting to talk. Now we're talking. This one can do this, that one can do that. Teamwork, and teamwork on a bigger scale with forethought. Now we're moving into a whole new world. And yes, it can be done, and we should be doing so much more of this. And a final pointer, we can look at all our history, we can look at what whites did everywhere, and you will find in the history of our people that a new tool allowed new forms of tactics and new forms of expansion. And we need to be looking for expansion and power. Power is very important. We need to be looking at group expansion, group unity, group power. That's what we're going for. We want to be more effective. If you look in our history, you will find that as far back as the Aryans, who used war chariots, that their instrument of expansion was the war chariot. You will find that the Vikings went and engaged in the most incredible things of all. And what enabled it? It was actually a very cleverly designed ship. They designed a special kind of ship that could not only sail in rivers, it could also sail on the high seas. The ship had all kinds of features, and the Vikings had this tool. And using this tool, they then began to physically expand, and later they even began to conquer. And it was all because of a tool that allowed them transportation. And if you look at whites throughout our history, you'll see tools, tools, tools. And again, I'm going to repeat, if somebody tells you to not use a phone, not use a laptop, not use a notebook, then that is like saying to somebody, take that AK-47 that you got in your hands, throw it away, and go back to using a spear. There are rare occasions where that kind of thinking does have value. And handwriting, for example, has its time and place where handwriting is useful. But it's not for most of the time. Most of the time, using these phones, using these devices, will allow you to do more faster. And a final point, if you want the best example of whites in the modern time who have used their personal capacity to the maximum, you can look no further than the Germans. The Germans are a people, are a very intelligent white people who do not have access to black labor or any kind of slave labor. They therefore have to approach everything in life as a group, and they are limited to their own physical abilities. And you will find that the Germans are as at home with a shovel as they are with a computer, as they are with a piece of artillery, as they are with studying science and chemistry and physics itself. They're as at home with a shovel as they are with mathematical formula, as they are with technical devices. So look at the Germans and look at the incredible achievements of the Germans. If I get past all the really important things, then one day in the years to come, I'd like to show you all the things the Germans have done. If you go and see the creativity of the Germans in World War II and prior to World War II, you will fall on your back. These people solved every problem known to man. And Germans and Europeans to this day, they have got various problems of their own. Among their problems are lack of territory and lack of resources. And you will find that Europeans especially are masters and gods of finding ways to solve problems intelligently while having extreme problems with resources. The Europeans are the highest developed people in our race when it comes to science, because science and technology is all that they've got, because they struggle with lack of physical resources, which are plentiful in North America, plentiful in South Africa and Australia, etc. So learn from the Germans. Germans have got an attitude and a work ethic that is second to none. Germans, in fact, do not tolerate laziness from other people in their culture. Germans have got a spirit that everybody must work, and everybody must get on and must work. And it's a brilliant cultural feature. And if whites, especially whites in Africa who've gotten used to using black labor, if whites in Africa could get back to using the Germanic model, you will find many, many huge benefits coming out of this kind of model. You won't believe what is possible if you start using this model. There are things that the blacks and the Jews assumed we would never be able to do. They assumed we were too soft and weak. And I want to tell you, if we do certain things that the blacks and the Jews did not expect, we will totally, totally shatter their plans for us. They will not know how to handle it. They will not know what to do if whites are able to physically take care of themselves without using non-whites. They will not know what to do with themselves. Their whole basis and their whole assumption for our destruction will completely fall apart. It will totally shatter to pieces. So if we can learn from the Germans and look at all the amazing things Germans have done, then you will see that in modern times, using physics, using technology, using science, you will be amazed at what is possible. And you need to look around you at all the kinds of knowledge that we need to acquire, but learn to use these things as tools. So, let's stop with the preaching, but I had to say that because I need to tell people, stop being afraid, get on with things. And don't worry about the spies. They can spy all they want. If all of us are doing things that are legal and that are allowed, then there is nothing wrong with it. And in actual fact, the main forms of harassment against whites, the main forms of harassment are actually coming from businesses and Jews. Jews and businesses are the main forms of harassment. Governments operate differently. Governments are very restricted by many different rules and laws, and that also works in our favor. And we will discuss that. But understand, look around the internet. Who is doing the most censorship? Who is trying to stop whites the most? You'll see it's all business related. You'll see it's business. Social media companies, newspapers. Who's threatening white people? Who's spreading information to harm white people, to scare white people? You'll see it's social media, it's newspapers, it's companies, it's businesses. It's always business related. Businesses are the number one problem that we face. Businesses and money-related stuff is the biggest problem we face. And it is wrong to assume that government is operating exactly on the same scale with the same tenacity as the businesses. Governments have a somewhat different view, and they've got also limitations on their powers. Yes, they also have powers that nobody else has. They can do things that nobody else can do. That is true. The NSA can read every single email. The NSA can read every single message that's passing through WhatsApp. Yes, these things are possible. But are they going to spend the time to focus on you? And if there are 100 of us each doing our activism, are they going to bother with all of us? You need to start looking at things in their proper context. And when I got into this computer stuff and I experimented with computer stuff, I began to realize many different things. And I learned things from other people, including my mentor, Dr. Chris Jordan. So don't be afraid of the tools. Get to use the tools. Get used to risk. Get used to being surrounded by spies and traitors and all sorts of things. Start thinking more carefully, observing people. Learn about technology. Learn about human beings. Learn about other white people. Start observing, interacting, developing your mind, developing your skills. Because your ability to analyze, your ability to think, and your ability to act will become ever more sharpened. And then you're going to be able to do amazing things. And when large numbers of us are doing stuff, the things that we're going to be able to do is going to shock people. The world is going to be astounded by what common white people can do. And whites have done it before. The only people who truly appreciate how dangerous we are the Jews. That is why Jews freak out so much. Jews are freaking out all the time because Jews know. Jews know the common white man. He's capable of a lot. Don't give him even 1 second of freedom because he's going to do incredible things. They know that. That's why they are harping and shrieking and whining and crying and screaming all the time. Roll up your sleeves, get active. Everybody's going to learn. And the more we learn, the more we interact with each other, the more we share with each other, the more we teach each other, the more we work as a group, you're just going to see it's going to get better and better and better and better. And I will show you some of the things that technology can do. So just a few pointers about technology. What can you expect from technology? The main advantage of technology lies in cutting costs. Cutting costs, speeding things up, and doing things that you couldn't do before. But the speeding things up and doing more, these are important parts of it. But it's also critical to know that the technology generally is going to cut costs. And while this might not be important in activism, this has got serious potential in other areas where people are thinking of doing things. And that's a topic that we'll revisit. And just some other notes about your technology, your devices, your computers, your laptops, your phones, your tablets. I notice in South Africa that family members and friends and others throw away or give away their equipment even to blacks. They'll take a phone that they've paid for over 2 years that they don't need anymore and they'll go and give it to a black. Really, I urge you to not do these kinds of things. Anything remains useful, even those old computers. You might not have a use for them, but they can be reused and they can be used by others. The reuse of old computers is itself a very fascinating thing. And really old computers, even old Windows computers, can be totally reused with other operating systems and you can function with them and use them. So I would advise you to not just throw things away. Try and hand it over to another white, to somebody who's needier than you. Hand your phones or your old tablet or your laptop or your PC to another white. Please don't just give these things to blacks. Please. Other things that I use from old machines, and I've got machines sitting here at my house. Some are up to 15 years old. These are machines that I've bought or had built up over the last 20 years. I've even got a machine that's at least 20 years old, still with the original operating system on it. There isn't much that even I can do with a 20-year-old machine, but I keep these things. They can come in handy. There are things that you can do with older machines. And you can also wipe out the operating systems and reuse them with other operating systems. That in and of itself is very fascinating. And there's even security stuff that you can do with other operating systems. There's a lot of really interesting things that can be done by those who are technically inclined. I like to keep old machines intact as they are. They have got uses. Like I say, and part of the reason is because you can put things on them, you can install operating systems, and the hardware can still work because everything is still compatible with itself. One part of old machines that I find myself using a lot is old disk drives. I keep all external disk drives, even really old ones, and internal disk drives that are inside the machines, are also very useful. That is one thing I can never get enough of. I grab as many of them as I can. I use all of them. The only ones that aren't of any use are the ones that are really, really old and really, really small in disk space. For example, a 4 GB disk drive. But otherwise, I use everything. And if there's one thing that I'm always happy to receive, it's disk drives, external or internal. I love those things. I use them. They are very, very useful for me. But don't just throw things away. Now, just some pointers about phones, because phones have got a lot of power and people don't even realize the power of phones. Many people type on their phones and certain devices and they type on them with their fingers as if they are pressing an old typewriter keyboard. There's no need for that. You can actually type very fast on a phone or a tablet or any device that's got a touch screen. You can actually type very fast on a touch screen by making use of a concept called swipe. And swipe is spelled SWYPE. Swipe. SWYPE. Swipe is a technology that allows you to type without lifting up your fingers. So all you do is you take your fingers and you write out the words and you connect them with straight lines and then it types faster. There are some things you learn while you're busy doing it, but I use it all the time and it's very fast. On Android phones, you don't get swipe. So on an Android phone, you install an app called SwiftKey. SWIFT. KEY. I spent quite a bit of time playing with Swipe and SwiftKey when those things came out, and I must tell you, I use them all the time. They allow me to type really fast. So remember to look at things that can speed things up. Once you learn more and more about these devices, you will realize how advanced they are. There are so many things that you can do with them. So that's just a little bit of technology background. Let's take a look at the actual issue of activism. And I'm going to read to you an email message that one of my supporters here in South Africa asked me. And I want to go through this in detail because there are many things that we can do. So this guy writes, "Hi Jan, just an idea. I don't know if this has been done before, but with your background and understanding of the media, I'm sure you can give input here. I know that NASPAS is National Press, it's an Afrikaans company, these are globalists and they are functioning even in China and they are totally liberal. They are liberal and 100% anti-white, they are true scum. They've been totally changed from what they were." Those are just my comments. So he says, "I know that NASPAS and News24 censor or bluntly refuse to report on farm murders and murder of whites in general. With the current upsurge in farm attacks and pressure building, perhaps we have some window of opportunity to put pressure on media houses. This morning I thought that just what if we get a shitload of people to publicly complain about News24 not reporting on the current farm attacks and not giving it fair coverage? I will send you a link of someone in the media at a certain media house that we can direct our complaints against. Perhaps we build up and flood this guy's inbox with our demands at fair farm attack coverage. I was thinking that with the DA, this is the Democratic Alliance, this is the Jewish-controlled Liberal Party in South Africa. I was thinking that with the DA now talking about farm attacks and the Freedom Front Plus, that's a conservative Afrikaans political party, talking, and also AfriForum lobbying the United Nations and everything, we can get a group of people to carry out this project to add more weight. I mean, we can basically flood this guy and other channels with recent farm attack reports that are verified and that they haven't reported on. I know this might be futile, but just what if we reach critical mass and at some point kick up enough dust that other competition media houses see this and indirectly help us to get our coverage out while they pick battles with News 24 on their unbiased reporting. Even greater would be if we can uncover evidence that there is some sort of policy to not report on farm attacks. Then we can send that out into the world. So that's what my young supporter wrote to me, and all of it is excellent, absolutely excellent. And he's already thinking way ahead. He's already thinking of the tactical use and also the group use of these devices and going after this with some kind of forethought and strategy. And I'm totally in agreement with that. What I will say is that it is not a futile exercise. Not a futile exercise. In fact, emails are more effective than other methods. For example, early on when I was on my websites in the early years, I was also thinking of this kind of thing, and I was looking at this kind of possibility. And I did a couple of things in this regard, minor things at the time, because things were more difficult to do back then. And I did have the idea of sending out emails, etc., to people, but back then I didn't know much about how these things really function. One thing which people did then, and they still do it, are petitions. Now, petitions where you've got to go and sign or click on a thing and then they can show that 100,000 people clicked this or a million got to that. Those things have got problems. There are two problems with them. The first one is if you go and you set your sights on a high number and then you struggle to get to that number and then you might end up with a much smaller number. And now it doesn't look so impressive, and it's also kind of demoralizing. So let's say you set out to do a petition, and you say, well, I want to get 100,000 people. And after a year of trying, you only find yourself with 6,000 people. Then you feel like you've lost. And in my own experience with regard to petitions, I've never yet seen that petitions alone were effective at dealing with any company. Because somebody can come and say, well, 100,000 people clicked on this page, and unless you can provide all the details of those people, you also aren't really packing a punch. What is much better is the email system, and you can get a lot more done with a lot less people. So even if you had 6,000 emails going out, let me tell you, 6,000 emails would pack a punch. I want to discuss various things that I've seen that show me that this method really works. The most interesting thing that I ever heard was when I was working at the bank. At the bank, I got myself involved in an email project. Somebody came to my boss and said that he runs the team of people that was handling the email address for that bank. Now, the banks have got lots of email addresses, but there was one email address which was like info@ and the bank name. And so he handles all the emails that come in there. And he had a team of about 30 staff, and all they ever did every day was read incoming emails and deal with them. And how I got involved was because he came to my boss and he said that he needs somebody to help him on this because it's very chaotic. They get so many emails coming in, they can't handle it and they don't know what to do with it. And that resulted in me getting involved in emails, and I jumped at the chance and I went on to almost specialize in this for the last few years that I was at the bank. And I learned a heck of a lot. I ended up writing software for the bank specifically for teams to handle emails. When large numbers of emails come in, I went and wrote something that allowed it to be handled by many people because it becomes incredibly chaotic. And as part of the exercise that I did, I ended up going to different parts of the bank and they all wanted to use my email system. And I ended up training almost 1,000 people in how to use my system and in how to handle large volumes of emails. So it was a very interesting thing, and I dealt with a bunch of different parts of the bank, and it was very, very educational. By the time I left the bank, my system had received 10 million emails, and people had written out 10 million replies, and I had all the emails stored away, it was searchable, etc., etc. So it was a really interesting exercise, and I learned a lot about email, and I really enjoyed it actually. It was good fun. Now, one day when I was talking to this guy who was handling this info at email address, one day he told me about an interesting incident that happened. Now, his 30 people were getting about 30,000 emails per month into that email account. So emails are pouring in and they don't know what they're going to get, so they have to go through it and look at it and analyze it. And he told me that one day the bank issued some kind of statement, and this statement had to do with whites, and this statement pissed off Afrikaans speaking whites in South Africa. It really ticked them off. And he said that within a day or two, 600 emails, I'm not sure if it's 600 or 650 emails, but you're looking at more than 600 emails came into his email address. And they were emails written by really angry Afrikaans people. And among the things that these people would write was they'd write things where they'd express their anger at what the bank had put out. And then they would threaten to shut all their accounts with the bank and move their money from the bank. Now, when these staff members get emails coming in, and the email is now dealing with something that they're not used to, they will go to their supervisors and they'll say, "Listen, I'm getting this thing, or I'm getting a lot of this, and what must I do?" Like in this case, they don't know what they must reply. So they don't just write any reply to the customer, and they go to their supervisor or their manager, and then they say, "Listen, I'm getting this. You know, what am I supposed to write back? Because I'm writing back on behalf of the bank." And then what happened as a result of all these things, the manager himself doesn't know what to write, so he escalates it to his boss, and so it goes on upwards. He told me that as a result of these 600 emails, they eventually escalated it right to the very top of the bank. Interestingly enough, at the very top of all these corporate structures, the guy who's actually in charge of, let's call it, operations and day-to-day stuff, etc., is almost always a white guy. If not a white guy, then an Indian, but hardly ever, if ever, a black. Anyway, this went all the way right to the top. And the guy at the top in charge of like the operational stuff or the CEO, he then had to make decisions on this. So this thing was escalated all the way up through the management structure, which is many levels. You're looking at maybe 10, 15 levels of ranks. Goes right to the top. They have to sit and have meetings. They have to inform the CEO. The CEO asks questions, people have to answer stuff, they have to find out, why did we say that? What did we mean? And how are we going to respond to all these angry people? Because nothing scares a big business more than angry customers, especially if those customers are going to cost them business. So now all these managers were hopping and a bopping around, jumping around like cats on a hot tin roof because of all these angry emails, and they've got to respond to these people. So the CEO came up with an idea of what the bank would make as a public statement, and then of course they then instructed these staff members, this is how you must reply to all those emails. So every single one of those emails then gets a reply. But what was interesting was that this manager in charge of this email section, he was a non-white, he was a colored guy, he was quite freaked out by this, and he specifically told this story to me to show me, the kinds of nasty things that can happen and how serious it becomes. And inside the bank, I noticed on many occasions that certain things getting out into the media really bothers the bank a lot. In the case of banks, banks especially, banks are very concerned about their image, especially if their image is tainted. They are very, very worried when people think that they are unreliable or unsafe, etc. They will go to endless lengths to try and dispel all those doubts and rumors, big time. In fact, once the bank that I worked for even claimed that they had been hacked. They claimed that they'd been hacked because money had gone missing. The reality was, and I discovered this later also from a senior manager whom I trusted, he told me quietly that the bank had not been hacked, that the money had been stolen by the staff. Staff had stolen the money, but the bank couldn't go out into the public and tell people that the staff are stealing the money, so they actually went and made a statement that the bank had been hacked. And I was involved in the software side of things, and I thought that we were making changes to prevent hacking, when in actual fact, that was just a cover story. Everyone was told that we'd been hacked, even the computer programmers. But the management knew that this was just a cover story. And I only found out about it months after it had happened. I only realized then that everything we'd been doing was actually just a game, that the real issue was to save the bank's name. So banks especially are extremely, extremely concerned about their image. Image is everything. They'll go to the greatest lengths to lie and to cover up anything that indicates that they are unreliable, untrustworthy, because they are so afraid that people will withdraw money from the bank. Another time in the bank, there was a very senior manager in our department, in our division actually, and he gave a talk to all the staff, and he spoke about unhappy customers. And at the time, that division in the bank was making a lot of money. And this guy was giving us a talk, and he said that when you make a customer happy, the effect is not as great as when you make a customer unhappy. And he said that statistics and studies in the past had shown that if you make a customer unhappy, he will, on average, tell at least three other people. Whereas if you make a customer happy, he'll tell one other person. And so he warned that you've got to be very careful of unhappy people because they can spread the message and it can hurt the organization. So these high-level managers of these businesses, they are very, very aware of the responsibility of keeping the image of the organization clean. If you study a guy like Jesse Jackson, the black guy in the United States, who was also a sort of leader of the blacks, Jesse Jackson made a career out of nothing but blackmailing big companies. He went to companies, charged them with racism, stirred up hatred against them and anger against them, and then they had to pay him off to silence him. Jesse Jackson. He did this to businesses all across America. Did it for many, many years. So that is also an example of how businesses have got a vulnerable side. And business has got many weak aspects to it. And in this discussion, I'm going to differentiate between business and state. There's a big difference between how businesses function and how state mechanisms function, government mechanisms function. Businesses are threatened by things that are going to affect their ability to get customers and to make profits. Anything that makes them feel uncomfortable, they're going to go after it like crazy. So nothing will hurt a business like bad publicity. Any kind of bad publicity will drive them nuts. In fact, I'll tell you of an incident that occurred with me. When I was running African Crisis in 2006, I began to make contact with the state president, the former state president of South Africa, P.W. Botha. His wife was very active on the internet, and I managed to get her email address, and then I sent him a copy of my book. And that led to me talking to him, and he'd phone me at my house, and he'd talk to me on the phone, and he'd tell me stuff, and I'd write it down, and I'd put it on my website. And among the things that he told me was that the newspaper, the Afrikaans newspaper Rapport, had a policy to not ever mention him at all. So I went onto my website and I wrote that the Afrikaans newspaper Rapport has a policy to never write any stories that mention P.W. Botha. Anyway, as the months went by, P.W. Botha invited me to his house. So I went to his house in the Cape and I stayed there for 5 days. While I was staying with him, guess who pitches up? Suddenly, out of the blue, without any warning, he gets a phone call that Rapport want to come and see him. And the next thing you know, while I'm sitting there at his house, there arrive two or three people. I can't remember exactly how many, but it was at least two people. I think it was two. I think it was a man and a woman arrived from Rapport. And I think the woman was a journalist, and I think the man was a photographer. Oh, goodness. There they arrive, and they were so cozy with P.W. Botha. They were busy yakking away to him, asking him how things are going, taking photographs, and then they went and they ran a lovely story about P.W. Botha. And I just sat and smiled about it, because I, with my little website, had written there that Rapport has got a policy to not mention P.W. Botha at all. And there, when I visited him, there is a Rapport. They arrived right there, all cozy and friendly and chummy, and the next day it's in the newspaper with photos and everything, all friendly-like, to now quietly indicate that I'd been writing a lot of nonsense. So even though my website is small, most of the Afrikaans people in the country don't even know my website exists. That story on my website must have reached them. And there are a number of occasions where I noticed that even though you are running a website and there aren't many people there, you'd be amazed how word can spread to the right or the wrong people. And that is why also when I do my videos and when I write on my websites, if I want to hide certain things, you'll see that I have a certain way of hiding things. If I don't want certain things to reach certain people, then I just hide their identities and nobody knows who they are. Because I have in the past, on my little website, written things and mentioned this person or that author or something, and I'll tell you, you'd be shocked at how quickly somebody can come to your website, or even you'll get an email from an attorney. I've had all kinds of things happen in the past, which showed me that a website can pack a punch, even if your audience isn't that big. But if your website is credible, see, if you write lots of endless rubbish, it's a whole different thing. Then nobody will care. But if they see that you start drawing people and the people that you're drawing are credible, then they'll get much more concerned when they see things on your website. And if they see that people start listening to you, then they want to shut it up and they want to get certain things to not happen. My own view is that these days the internet is so censored, there are so many things that are just disappearing off the internet, left, right, and center. But I've seen some of the vulnerabilities of these companies, and I want to tell you that these businesses, one can take them on. If one can do this properly, then this is something that can work. Probably the most brilliant example of attacking a company done by whites in South Africa that I know of was Spur. Spur is a fast food outlet and it's based on a sort of American Indian kind of a look. And in South Africa, anything cowboy and American is fun. So Spur was a fast food outlet that had a lot of Afrikaans people as customers. People loved going to Spur and buying their products. And then there was something that happened at Spur. I can't remember what it was. I'm not sure if it was an Afrikaans person who was maltreated. And this thing got out, and it angered Afrikaans people to such a degree that they then said they were going to boycott Spur. So you see that image on the screen there, that thing there with the Indian and Spur, and it says empty ranches, a taste for racism. That was one of the things I think that came from that time. That is where whites were really furious with the way a white person had been treated at Spur. From what I remember, whites boycotted Spur to such a degree that I think Spur lost something like 20 million rand. I'm not sure if they even lost 20 million rand in a single month. Spur was boycotted to such a degree by whites, especially Afrikaans speakers, that they had to apologize publicly, they had to do a whole bunch of things in order to make whites happy again. They lost so much money. And from my understanding, I would say that the Afrikaans and white boycott of Spur steak ranches was the most successful boycott in all the time that I've been in South Africa. The blacks have got the numbers and they can boycott, but this was one time when the whites were so enraged that they really damaged this business. They caused it such financial harm, and this is just our small white population, but they harmed this business and the company was really struggling. Let me just read to you some sections from an article on the British dailymail.co.uk website, because this will show you how effective this boycott was. And it says here, racial tensions mount in South Africa after boycott by whites of restaurant chain after it sided with a black woman who rowed with a white man over the behavior of her children. Racial tensions are mounting in South Africa as whites continue to boycott Spur. The boycott follows a racist row between a black woman and a white man in 2017. The argument, caught on tape, was over the behavior of the woman's children. Spur apologized to the woman for not sufficiently assisting her, while the man, this is the white man, was banned for his aggressive and unacceptable actions. So once you'd seen the film footage, this had now pissed off the whites, and the whites said that this white man had been maltreated. And so the whites just went after them. Let me read a bit more. Racial tensions are mounting in South Africa as whites continue to boycott a popular restaurant chain following a racist row between two customers from 2 years ago. Spur Steak Ranches was once a prominent family dining chain with a Western American theme dotted around the country that began serving customers since 1967 and even adapted to the social changes following apartheid. Keith van Eerden, a former customer of Spur for 3 decades, told the New York Times, "Spur is only for blacks now. They don't want the whites." Shocking footage captured an aggressive, foul-mouthed argument between two parents in front of small children at the restaurant. The mother leapt to her child's defense and branded the man a coward. Later in the video, the man lifts up the table and shakes it, sending cutlery crashing to the floor. Spur issued an apology to the woman for not sufficiently assisting her, while the man was banned for his aggressive manner and unacceptable actions. So you see, this company, in typical form, these big companies, they just wipe their backsides on the whites. They just say, no, they just want black customers. If the whites get in the way of the blacks, they'll just kick the whites aside. So they banned this white man from Spur, and that's when the whites went into action. So let me explain here, let me read some more. The ban imposed on the man was seen outraged. The English in this Daily Mail article is very bad. And this is a British website. I'll read it as it is. It says, "The ban imposed on the man was seen outraged the white community who demanded that both customers should have been banned." So I wonder if there are people who are English speakers who even write for this Daily Mail in the UK. But now listen to this. Johan Pienaar, this is a white Afrikaans guy, a brand expert who was previously a consultant for Spur on managing the boycott, told the publication that no one in the country thought it would be as effective as it is. So they all thought, ah, a couple of whites, what are the whites going to do to this big business chain? So listen to this. 6 months following the protest, honestly, I don't know who the people are who write these articles. This article must have been written by somebody who doesn't know English well. Let me just read it as it is. 6 months following the protest, the chain's sales dropped by more than 9%. And owners of franchises, ah yes, it's a franchise, and owners of franchises in predominantly white suburbs began to lose money, and by the way, lose is spelt wrongly, and sell off their restaurants. The company's chief operating officer, Mark Farrelly, said in an interview during the height of the boycott that they were facing a right-wing backlash. Oh God, these sentences, I'm like adding words in because this thing is so badly written. This is the dailymail.uk. So then the next thing is, in response, the leader, I'm telling you, they don't know what they're writing about here. I'm going to have to add in words so that it actually reads like English. In response, the leader of Solidarity, an influential white minority trade union, wrote in an open letter, "This is about a community that feels estranged in the country. Now they feel strange. Now they feel strange at their favorite restaurant as well. But amid all the tension around the boycott, some diners don't feel any racial tension. Despite all the furor around the boycott," so this is quoting a black woman, and a black woman says, "Everybody is welcome. But as you can see, the boycott was effective. And there were even franchise owners selling their restaurants because whites in their neighborhoods boycotting them that much." So this is the most successful boycott of a big business in South Africa that has ever been carried out by whites. And if it can have that kind of effect on them, then that should show you there's a lot of potential. And these big businesses, they all pander just to the blacks, and they treat the whites like shit. And in that case, whites hit back, and they really hit back hard. And I'm sure that we can do a heck of a lot more if we work out our plans and we work together. We can really do things. I think what made this particular boycott so effective was that Solidarity, the trade union, which has a lot of money, was that Solidarity played a big part in this, in providing the money and the media coverage, etc., for this. And this really hurt Spur. And let me tell you, other businesses will watch. And if we can hurt businesses in various ways, if they are anti-white, then we're onto the right thing. And Jews themselves, all around the world, are constantly attacking anybody for anti-Semitism, and they make lots and lots of noise. And even though they're a small group, they use all their power and their buddies, etc., and they harm businesses and they try to get people fired, etc. So making lots of noise is a good way to stir up things and to harm businesses. And whites can do it, man. Even though we're not that many, yes, this is one of the possibilities, definitely. Now let's talk a little bit about emails and some of the technical aspects of emails and using emails as a method of putting pressure on people. One of the possibilities with emails, and this is what I was trying to do long, long time ago, a little bit, and other people have also done it. There are actually websites that specialize in sending out mass emails, and you can have some kind of form that you fill in and it'll generate an email and send it off. The thing you've got to be careful of with using a website to spread lots of emails is that emails have become a battleground, and emails have become a battleground with spammers and phishing, etc. So over the years, the rules regarding email have tightened a lot, and I learned about this myself with my own website stuff that I was doing. The problem with sending large numbers of emails, you can actually have a website. One could set up a website, for example, and one could set up a website and you could even generate emails with fake names. Fake names, fake email addresses, and you could actually inundate a company with emails from your website, for example. One can do such things. In other words, you don't worry about using real people, you just inundate them with emails from lots of fake people. That is technically possible. The downside of doing that is that email servers are so clever these days that if you do such things, that they have methods of detecting and rating emails, and you might find that emails in the beginning start getting through, and then later on they just tighten up on it, even automatically, and your emails will start ending up as spam. And then once the emails from your website get regarded as spam, then any future emails that you send will also end up being dealt with as spam. So you can use automated methods to blast out lots of emails, but because it comes from a website, because it comes from a server, it will have lower priority and the chance that it gets treated as spam is ever higher. So what they really try to do on the internet is they really want to know that when an email comes from somebody, that the email comes from a single individual, a human being. And so built into all the software, phones, into the computers, into the websites that send email, like Gmail, for example, they've all got methods and things in their headers that allow them to identify themselves as being sent by a real human being. So it is best that real people send real emails. Even so, one could go and work out methods and create a little project and let people write up some possible letters, and then you share it with people, and people start spreading it. And then each person has some emails to choose from, and he can start blasting it off to other people. That will work. As long as you send the email yourself from your device, and it's you that's sending it, then it won't end up as spam. All the servers will allow your email to get through, and it'll go through fine. But what one could do is one could either form a team or a project and make it easy for other people to come and send the emails. So you could target multiple companies, multiple areas, multiple topics, and you could make it so that people blast out emails to various companies with some decent content in them. And in that regard, if you have somebody who like draws up an email format with some nice wording in it that states the case, etc., and then you copy that, but you maybe make a few modifications, add in a few things to customize it for yourself, then it looks more genuine and it comes from different people at different times. The wording may be similar, but not exactly the same. And then the people who are reading it will say, yeah, this comes from real people. We're not just being spammed. And then they'll take it seriously. So, yes, the idea of doing projects and getting emails to certain people and to flood certain people's email addresses, yes, the whole concept can work. And then it becomes a case of what do you put in the email, what kind of threats do you make, etc. And you can make certain types of threats. The other thing is you can also just show them that you're extremely angry. And you can even just say things like, I'm going to tell other people about it. The only things you mustn't put in there is you mustn't put in things like, I'm going to come to you with a gun and I'm going to shoot you. You don't want to go and do stuff like that. But other kinds of threats, especially customer-related threats, oh, I'm unhappy, I'm outraged. And if you look at the way blacks and Jews operate, they also are outraged by anything that suits them. There are no firm rules as to what should and should not outrage you. And so that's something that we can play on. We can say, hell, that thing outrages me. Who's to say whether we should or should not have been outraged? But if we say we feel outraged and we're angry and we write something forceful, I think also if you write something forceful, it's good because it's going to get the person who reads it, it's going to get their blood pressure up. And if they start getting a couple of those things coming in, it'll start pissing them off and ruining their day. And that's exactly what you want. That's exactly what you want. You want to put them under stress. You do want stress. They put us under stress all the time. They lie about us. They threaten us. And it's time that we started turning the tables on these people. One thing that my supporter mentioned was that, maybe if we target certain media houses, then others might take advantage of it and expose them and try and sort of win people over, etc. I'm not fully convinced that that's what will happen. The mass media, when it comes to whites, the mass media as a whole are not pandering to whites. Unless there is some reason to believe that certain newspapers and certain media outlets are actually selling to whites and that whites are the majority of their customers. If that is the case, then yes, you might find some of them helping us. But in the time that I've been active, I've not seen any real indication that they will help us. And they are pretty much all anti-white. And even if there were some of them that were pro-white, I don't think they'll stand up for us in public. So I don't think that they will turn on each other. I think that the way forward is to attack them all. I think that's the best way to deal with them, is go after all of them. Don't just go after the biggest one. Go after all the big ones. You can send the same emails to all of them. And you write to them and you say, hey, why aren't you reporting this? Why aren't you reporting it? Don't say that you've been telling other people. Just say to them, why aren't you reporting it? And of course, then you also get these Afrikaans ones who've become totally liberal, like all the Naspers outlets. And if one goes after them, then if it's Afrikaans people who go after them, then it's even more effective. In that case, in South Africa, language might even assist in this, that if they see that the person writing to them is writing to them in Afrikaans, and this person is angry, they might be even more concerned because their media outlet is catering for Afrikaans people. So one could approach it in that sort of way. But I'd say go after everybody. They don't have to know that you're going after everybody. You just go after everybody. Tell each one the same thing. Why aren't you doing this? And of course, if it's the biggest one, you can say, "You are the biggest one. Why aren't you doing this? Are you asleep on the job?" Etc., etc. "You outrage me. I'm not going to support you anymore." You can even lie to them. You can even say to them, "I've always bought your newspaper, but now I'm going to stop. I'm sick and tired of the way that you carry on." There was even a time when some of the newspapers, a couple of years ago, 5 or so years ago, there was even a time when some of the newspapers, like the English-speaking Star newspaper, would put white criminals on the front page of the newspaper. Sons of bitches. They would actually just focus on white crime. They'd find whatever handful of whites who'd committed crimes, they'd put them on the front page of the newspaper. And I say go after all of them. They're all scum. Go after the whole lot of them. Every one of them is anti-white. All these big corporates in South Africa, they all pander to the blacks endlessly, and one should attack them. Another thing that can also help in the case of farm murders is attaching photographs. And in that sense, I've been getting some recent photographs that are really horrific. And one should attach photographs and say, "Why are you not publishing these photos? Look at what's happening to these people." Another thing about the mass media in South Africa that's an interesting twist, an interesting South African twist, is this, and it's just worth keeping in mind, is that there is a law that if a newspaper writes a story about something, that the newspaper has to contact the person or persons that they are writing the story about. They have to contact that person to get that person's comments and input. So that's also something to keep in mind in the back of your head, because if you come across something where they write about some white guy and they don't publish the white guy's comments, then that is something that you can stir up some noise with. If you look carefully in the South African newspapers, you'll see that when they write stories, they might say, "We tried to contact this person, but we could not get an answer." And that is all because of that law. So that is also something that we can use under certain conditions. But email is the official way to get things done in this modern day and age. You can get all sorts of things done by email. Everybody accepts email. You can do official government business with email. So yes, email sent from a person, whether it's from your phone or from your laptop or from your computer or your tablet, yes, it'll work. And of course, the other side of the coin is there's nothing stopping us from doing things internationally. If we've got friends overseas who also want to write to these South African newspapers, that could be fun as well. Let somebody write and say, "I live in Texas and I just want to tell you, I'm hearing about farm murders from people who are privately affected by this stuff, and why don't you do anything? And this is disgusting, blah, blah, blah." And you can write as a foreigner. There's nothing stopping foreigners from writing to these South African newspapers and taking them on, or even these South African businesses. Whites who support us outside the country can be just as effective. In fact, it might even scare them more because they're starting to realize, "Goodness me, is this getting out of the country? This is not good." And it might spread, and there are a lot of whites outside the country. Inside the country, there might just be 4.5 million whites whom you can kick around as you please, But what if it starts getting to America and Europe and starts spreading around? So I think that those kinds of things can work. Another thing is if you write the email, write with your own name and your own details. You only really have to give them your name and surname. That's all they really need from you. But it is good to write and write as a real human being. That's important. Now let's talk about governments, because governments are also a way of doing things, and you can get lots done with that too. So let me explain to you the process of dealing with governments and activism with governments. And also, you can go and do activism using political parties and newspapers outside South Africa as well. You can also go after political parties that might be slightly on our side, because mostly nobody's on our side. But you can go and use political parties in other countries, write to them as well. I would like to add that if we can set things up in such a way that any whites who want to take part in these projects, that it's easy for them to get the data, easy for them to get possible email templates, that they can see lists of issues that need to be dealt with, because it doesn't just have to be farm murders. It can be murder, it can be all kinds of things. We can go after people for not employing whites. And another thing that's also coming up a lot is threats to whites. These same newspapers are publishing threats where they are saying that whites who run groups on phones can go to jail. Now, these kinds of things need to be dealt with and need to be countered, and I'll talk more about that later. But there are many, many things that we can use that we can really get angry about and, tell these people, hey, what is this nonsense? Why are you trying to stop our free speech? Why are you trying to infringe on our human rights? You and I know that human rights are really a bunch of fake rubbish, mostly aimed at non-whites and Jews. But, throw those words at them too. Pretend that we also have human rights and that they matter and that we're angry that we don't have our human rights. And yeah, keep these people busy. Piss them off. Scare them. Ruin their day. Now, what can add to this is that in this COVID super lockdown that we've got here in South Africa, business is in such a sad state. Whereas in America, people are recovering and they're moving fast and gaining back ground, in South Africa, there is massive economic damage already. And these newspapers have and media houses have not been making money. So I think that we're in a great situation where these media houses have not been earning much money, things are bad, the country is bad, the last thing they want is more bad stuff coming their way. I think it's a perfect time to start putting some heat on them. I've been watching in the shops I go to where the newspapers and magazines are normally lying. They've not been printing newspapers for months now. And what few issues are out there, it's not much. They must have been losing lots and lots of money. It's a good time to go after them. And I think that the ruin to the economy is such that they're going to be struggling for quite a time. I don't think South Africa is going to recover from this COVID thing anytime soon. I think that we're going to be battling with this stuff for more than a year, maybe even longer. And the damage to the economy is almost permanent. So this is a good time to start scaring businesses because they themselves are in a tight spot. Now let's take a look at governments, activism by way of governments. The guy that you see on the screen there, that is Dr. Chris Jordaan. That was the guy who helped me the most, by far, in the days when I was doing Zimbabwe activism. I only really got into politics as a direct result of the Zimbabwean government seizing the land of the white farmers in Zimbabwe. And I realized then that this is very bad news for South Africa, that this thing will eventually come to South Africa. So I tried to get involved in doing anything regarding Zimbabwe, and that is where I started my website, and that is where I started my activism. Until then, I had never ever bothered with politics in public, but that was the last straw for me. And I saw them chasing farmers off their land in Zimbabwe. I found that too much to bear, and I decided that I must really get involved. People are just sitting around, and in actual fact, a huge disaster is occurring here. So I had no experience at political activism. I'd never done it before, and I was busy setting up a website, just trying to get going. And the guy that I contacted, because I began to write my book as well, the guy who was the most help to me of all was this guy that you see on the screen there, Dr. Chris Jordaan. That photograph of him was taken just a short while before he died. He had cancer and he'd kept it a secret from most of us. I didn't even know he had cancer until 3 weeks before he died. And by the time I got to him to visit him, I saw him the evening before he died. Dr. Chris Jordaan was actually a Christian priest in the military, but he also was in military intelligence for 20 years. And Chris Jordaan had lots of contacts in military intelligence, some of whom I also managed to either make contact with or get material from. So Chris Jordaan turned into the most useful person who would give me advice as things got, let's call it, hotter and hotter. As I was trying to put out information about Zimbabwe, I was also trying to get information. A lot of the information that I could get came from blacks. Quite a number of blacks fled from Zimbabwe to South Africa and lived in Johannesburg. Some of them were even involved in open protests in the streets of Johannesburg against the Zimbabwe government. And I made contact with these blacks, and from them I obtained some very interesting and useful stuff. And it was Chris Jordaan who I went to and confided in and told him what was going on and what I was finding. And when I really ran into trouble, then I would turn to him. He lived in Pretoria, and if things got really hot and I was really concerned, I would not even talk to him on the phone. I would drive to Pretoria and I'd go and see him, and he would help me and he'd give me advice. This guy gave me the best advice of anybody that I dealt with in all the time that I did political activism. And so I want to tell you a few of the things that he told me. Because some of the stuff that was going on involved people getting killed, etc., and there were also Zimbabwean spies functioning in South Africa, there was a whole bunch of covert nonsense going on. And Zimbabwean intelligence agents from the CIO, the Central Intelligence Organization, were functioning here in South Africa, etc., etc. So it was pretty nasty. And then, of course, the South African government allows them to do this, and the South African government helps them. At a point, while they were busy smashing the white farmers in Zimbabwe, the Zimbabwean government even had the balls and the gumption to request a loan of 1 billion rand from the government of South Africa. And of course, the South African government were going to give it to them. But this is one of many instances where either it didn't happen because of possible subtle intervention by Western nations. But the South African president of the time, Thabo Mbeki, whom the Jews and liberals loved to bits, this son of a bitch did everything in his power to assist the Zimbabweans, to lie in concert with them, to cover up for them, to hide things. He hid everything. He lied about everything. And liberals and Jews loved this guy. So at a point when things were getting quite serious and I was getting some serious information, and I went to see Dr. Chris Jordaan, he told me some interesting things. Now, I have his CV. He gave it to me at a certain point. And Chris Jordaan told me that in his 20 years in military intelligence, that he was also well known in intelligence circles in Europe. You see, the South Africans often interacted with Europeans. So these South Africans dealt directly with Europeans and traveled to Europe as they needed to, even in the military. Chris Jordaan then started explaining to me how some things worked. And at a point, he said to me, "This stuff that you've got here, I think the best thing for you to do now is for you to send this to the United States government." That was his suggestion. And he explained to me that when you send anything to the US government or to any other government, that there are formal processes, and that if you send them a message, they cannot just ignore your message. They have got firm procedures that every single thing that they get, they have to deal with it in some way. So he basically got me to start submitting information to the US Embassy. And he said to me that regardless of what I might want, that is not how the process works. All that I can do is submit information to them. They have to deal with it in one way or another. But what they do might not be what I want. However, by informing them of things, that's the best that you can do. So what I did was these blacks had all kinds of things that they were telling me and showing me. Sometimes they even had photographs. I got some really good photographs also from them about what was happening in Zimbabwe. And just for the record, to show you how sensitive these black governments can be once you start getting information out. Once I started publishing photographs on my websites, after a period of time, the Zimbabwe government actually enacted legislation in Zimbabwe making it illegal for people to take photographs of certain things in Zimbabwe. And if people were walking around in Zimbabwe taking photographs, they could just be arrested just like that, and they could find themselves in jail. On many occasions since that time, I have known blacks in Zimbabwe or blacks who I worked with in South Africa at the bank who came from Zimbabwe, and on a number of occasions, I asked them to take some photographs for me. Even benign photographs that had no public value. Like, for example, I wanted photographs of my dad's grave in Harare. And the blacks were always friendly, but nobody ever took any photographs. And some told me outright that if they walk around and they are seen taking photos, the police will be on to them in no time at all. And they're going to get either a beating or they're going to be in jail or something. So that is a law that exists. And there are even some other black countries where they are very sensitive about photographs showing their sad state and it getting out onto the internet and it embarrassing them. So this is also an example for you to realize that publishing things on the internet and getting facts out can be so embarrassing to the blacks that if they can't get their intelligence agents and other people to stop you, that they actually will enact a law to make it illegal. And those laws are real laws. So that's just to show you that a black country can be that embarrassed by things like that. And there are strange things that the blacks do legally, that their governments do, that shows you how sensitive they are to certain kinds of criticism. Other laws, for example, have to do with mocking and joking about presidents. In Zimbabwe, they made a law that if you mock the president, you can go to jail. And other black countries have done this stuff as well. You won't find that in the Western world, but in black countries, there are things that they are very sensitive to. In an indirect way, it shows their inferiority and their sense of inferiority. And that they need to hide things. And they need to hide and lie about many things. Anyway, Chris Jordaan got me to start submitting reports to the US Embassy. Now, in the beginning, and this also shows you how things have changed to a degree, in the beginning, these embassies did not even want to speak to white people. When I started my activism, the atmosphere here in South Africa and Southern Africa was as liberal as it is in the United States in 2020. You could not say the slightest thing about blacks. You could not say that they had a lower IQ. You could not insinuate that they were anything other than liberals. To even say that these black governments of Southern Africa were communists, even that was something that I got attacked for immediately by liberals and Jews on the internet in South Africa. The slightest thing that I said, I had to present evidence and more evidence and more evidence. They attacked me. They tried to mess me around in all sorts of ways. They did a number of things to me that are the same things that get done to Americans now. They tried to harass me in any silly way that they could. If I put up a book, for example, say somebody had written a good book, and it might be a liberal, but it's a good factual book, and I think that it would be useful to people. And I mention it on my website. I simply mention, this is the book, this is its cover, this is what the book is about, that's the author. The very next day, I would get an email from the author threatening me with legal action if I don't remove details of his book from my website. I said nothing negative, but they would attack me immediately. It's the same kind of harassment that Americans have now, where they go after everything. And in the beginning, it was like that. Now, the embassies dismissed anything that any white person said. They just dismissed a white outright as a racist. So the way that I did things in the beginning, and for a very long time, was that blacks would come with information. The blacks would tell me stuff and explain things that they'd seen or heard or whatever. And I would sit and I would actually make notes and I would write up reports of the stuff that the blacks told me. And then when I'd written all the reports up, I would then contact the Americans and arrange a meeting between the blacks and the Americans. And then I would give the blacks these documents that I'd written based on what they'd told me. Because their writing and their compilation of things was no good. And I did this for a number of years, and this was how I managed to get some information to the Americans, was to write up the reports, use the blacks, and then make the blacks contact the Americans physically. Later, I even used a black to contact different embassies, and then he would tell me what the embassies said. For example, he told me that the Canadian embassy was very friendly, and the Canadians were quite happy to try and help, etc., and were interested in the problems of Zimbabwe. However, he told me that when he went to the British embassy, that the British embassy didn't want to have anything to do with anybody who was against the government. In other words, the British were 100%, the Jewish-controlled British, I should say, were 100% in tune with all the hideous actions of the Zimbabwe government. They had no problem with it. They would not entertain any black who was a dissident against the communist Robert Mugabe. After I did this stuff for a couple of years, it came a point where the ANC began harassing me directly, and their people would phone me and threaten me and tell me to shut down my website, and also they would leave messages for me on my website telling me to shut my website down. My websites were also hacked many times, totally wiped out, and that happened a number of times. So there came a time when I was really starting to get afraid because there was definite heat on me. And it was then that I actually went and communicated with the Americans and asked them for their help. And it was then only that the Americans found out that I was the guy behind all the stuff that the blacks had been giving them. It was only then in the discussions that this came out and I told them. Anyhow, that contact, I am absolutely certain, helped to save me when the ANC came after me. I also stopped my website for about 6 months as well. And after that, when I resumed things were fine. And I never again had those threats that I had before. And to this day, I'm totally convinced that the American official that I met with, that he actually saved me. But of course, you never know what can happen in the future. They can always come and try and make new trouble or try and mess you around in other ways or destroy what you're doing in other ways. So one is never really certain. But anyhow, these experiences in the early 2000s, in the first 6 or 7 years, these experiences helped me to get some kind of understanding of what goes on. Another thing that Chris Jordan told me was that all these embassies from Europe that are in South Africa, because all the embassies are sitting in Pretoria, they have got a club, a social club, and all the staff of these embassies take part in the various social events. They get together, they have drinks, and then they also talk shop. And of course, you must know that embassies are not just there to represent their government, they're also spies. They're also looking to see what are things like in South Africa, what is the situation like. And then they also chat to each other and they exchange information. So he explained to me that basically all these European embassies, all these Western embassies, are constantly exchanging information even as they're sitting in the country, and they each have their own spies and they each have their own networks. Now, the thing that you must remember about governments, governments versus the mass media, governments compared to big businesses, corporate businesses, liberal and Jewish businesses, is that governments operate in secrecy almost completely. Governments do not sit and make statements and issue things discussing what they do. For the most part, most everything is secret. They operate quietly all the time. All the time. If you still believe that the mass media is a fair representation of what actually goes on in the world, you're wrong. A great deal of what goes on in the world, including the Western world, never sees the light of day. It never comes to the fore. The newspapers won't get hold of it. And this represents the secrecy of these systems. States, Western states, operate a lot like the police. If you were to go in a first world country to a police station and you were to report a crime and they were to assign some detectives to look into the matter, they might ask you to make a statement, to write down an affidavit, etc. But those detectives are not going to spend all their time giving you feedback. You won't even know what they're thinking. You won't know what leads they have. They will go and do their investigation and carry out all their procedures without you knowing the result. Until maybe one day they announce that they've arrested somebody. But otherwise, the entire process is totally secretive. You give them information, you give all your details, etc. And then they disappear until the day they arrest someone and there's a trial. Now that is how Western embassies and Western governments function. They operate in a very secretive way. They also have got very formal processes, extremely formal processes. And the way that they operate and the things that they say and do, there are almost like fixed behavior patterns, fixed modus operandis, according to which Western governments operate, even now. Among their methods of operation will be the ambassador or somebody else going and meeting directly with the president or somebody in power, or they can even just sit down and write an official letter to the South African government. And simply the act of writing a letter very politely and raising certain concerns or stating certain things, something as simple as that has power. And even though these blacks are independent, they too have to watch themselves to some degree. Now the Western world in its basic form does not want violence and war in South Africa. In fact, what they are trying their utmost to do is to try and see to it that South Africa does not break down into a racial conflict and that South Africa can operate peacefully. They really have no interest in a war in South Africa, and they certainly don't want to see one starting. And they do everything they can to help these blacks on the basis that these blacks have said that they never get an opportunity. Thus, the entire Western world deals with all these miserable blacks in Africa, and it deals with them politely, and it listens to all their shit, and the Western world assists these useless bastards whenever they ask for anything. They'll assist them in all kinds of ways. They'll send them specialists, they'll give them knowledge, they will even carry out special functions for them and assist them in all kinds of ways. I suspect that the Western world also monitors crimes and certain things, and at times it will even notify the South Africans. This is my own theory. What I'm telling you now is my own theory. I'm willing to bet you that they will at times even notify the South African government that they are aware of certain criminal activity. They'll even tell them what the criminal activity is, and they will assist and help them and push them into solving certain criminal activity. Let's say, for example, big organized crime drug pushers, for example. They might do something along those lines if it affects them. The Western world is acting like a parent, a friendly parent to a stupid child, and the child is also lying and carrying on. And the Western world acts as if this stupid child never got any opportunities, and now they're busy giving this stupid child all the opportunities that it can get. But the point is that these governments are doing things and they operate quietly. Now, of course, these blacks have got their independence. The blacks can spit in the face of the Western world. The blacks can ignore what they want to ignore. But there are also quiet, subtle pressures that the West tries to put on these blacks. And I suspect that there are times when it gets too much for these blacks. And whenever you see these blacks running off to Russia and China and Cuba, then you must know that things are getting too hot for them, and that they now are calling on their communist buddies because they don't want to take this pressure from the West anymore, even though this pressure is very soft and gentle. One cannot say exactly how effective the Western world's pressures were on Zimbabwe. I do think that the Western world basically prevented huge disasters, mainly for the blacks, actually. When Robert Mugabe seized the farms, he openly said that he was happy even if half the population of Zimbabwe had to starve to death. It would be worthwhile to get rid of the white farmers. This will give you an idea of how absolutely extremist and rabid these bastards are. But the South African government is also somewhat rabid, but not quite as bad as the Mugabe government. However, they look up to what Mugabe did, and they would definitely like to repeat many of those things. They definitely worked hand in glove with him, year in and year out. But these Western governments have, very quietly, I'm convinced, prevented enormous disasters. Like, for example, millions of blacks just starving to death in Zimbabwe. Which, personally, I'm very sad about, because I believe they should have left them all to die. But the Western world tries quietly to sort of make things chug along without things exploding completely. It is their goal to have peace. That is important for them. I will discuss more of these things much later when I discuss civilizations and what the elite view of America really is. But for our purposes, the Western world does not want racial conflict, and the Western world will try to resolve things in some way. Of course, they will do it in such a way that nobody can say it's racist. They will do it in such a way that all the crybaby, screeching blacks get most of what they want. So it's not going to work so great for whites, but it's not that nasty either. They just want to try to keep the peace and allow things to sort of chug along in a certain way. One of the reasons I'm in favor of using embassies is because I don't trust the government of South Africa at all. The government of South Africa lies about everything, including farm murders and crimes against whites. They openly say there is no such thing as farm murders, and they constantly try to indicate that anything that whites say is extremist and that it's not really real. So in these communications between the South African government and the Western world, I'm sure that the topic of farm murders has come up many times, and then these blacks just say, well, you see, these whites are just a bunch of lying racists, they're just resentful of us, and these lying whites just make up any story. I'm quite sure that that is how this has run for many years. But now, thanks to the internet and activism in bits and pieces, I think over the years the Western world must have realized more and more that the blacks are lying and that there are times when the whites are telling the truth. But I think it's very important that we tell our truth to other governments, because if we don't tell our truth to the other governments, then the only people that they have communication with are the South African government itself. And if the president and all these ministers lie about us in secret, which we don't know about, all quietly in their communications, in their personal meetings, then all these Western governments are obtaining information which is wrong, and we don't know about it. And of course, the mass media will never even know about it, or if they know about it, they won't publish it, because they are such a bunch of anti-white scum. It is therefore important for us to tell our side of the story and to provide as many facts as we can to the foreign governments, to the Western governments, so that they are aware of what is actually going on. And this then gives them two sources of information. If they get information from the whites, and they then ask the government, you know, did this really happen, what's going on here, etc., they can, as independent outsiders, observe what the blacks are saying versus what we are saying, and they themselves have got their own information channels and their own ability to check up on certain things. So over a period of time, I think it will be very positive for us whites if we can get good and accurate information directly to Western governments, because then it allows them to check more and more as to who's telling the truth. And I don't think that this is a wasted exercise. Let me just give a bit more background on times when I've contacted foreign governments. The first time was due to those farm invasions in Zimbabwe, which carried on for 10 years. So in that first period of about 5 to 7 years, it was in there that I communicated with them and did various things. However, after that, I stopped communicating with the US government. And I didn't see a need for sending them any information. And also, at that time, it was only the US government that I gave information to. So it was for quite a time that I didn't communicate with them at all, until 2017. It was only in 2017 that I began the process again of communicating, initially with the US government, and then I expanded it to more and more. The thing that got me to start doing this was Kulini. The blacks were burning down the houses of whites in Kulini. The blacks were threatening the whites. The blacks were causing enormous mayhem there. And the stress and tension between the blacks and whites was reaching very dangerous proportions. So then I began to take information that I was getting from Kulini, and some of it was not that accurate, but I took the information that I had as best I had it, and I began to send that through to the US government. The basis on which I worked was that anything that threatens the lives of whites, that is when I would go and communicate with the US government and start telling them stuff. I'd say to them, listen, I'm getting this information, blacks are doing that, and I would send them the information. Now, in my communications with them, other than that one time when I met an official many years ago, all the communications occur literally without any feedback whatsoever. Anything that I send just disappears. I never hear anything. I'm not told whether it's been received. I know nothing. It just goes and it's gone. There are no emails indicating what happened or why. And that is how most communication goes with these governments. But the main thing is that you're at least feeding information into a proper system. It goes into that system, and through that embassy, it can get into the intelligence services, police, etc. of that country. And that's the key thing, is that one is feeding information, and that information will reach somebody. Some analyst or some person somewhere is going to get that information, and that person will have to look at it and maybe make a note of it, add it to statistics, or use it in whatever way he thinks is right. And in that sense, you are feeding into a procedural system that exists, and all the Western countries have this system. In fact, probably everybody has it. But for our purposes, the only ones we're concerned with are the Western countries. So my basic concern is whenever whites' lives are in danger, that's the time that I talk. If I see the blacks wanting to kill whites, then that is the time that, because I don't have any other method at my disposal, the only thing I can do is to at least tell a government. So Collini was really the thing that started me back onto this thing of communicating with foreign governments. And initially, it was just the American government. But then I watched as this President Ramaphosa, who General Tini Groenewald had warned me about, Groenewald had told me back in the time after 2000, he'd said to me, if Ramaphosa ever becomes the president of South Africa, then the whites are finished. And another friend of mine was saying to me that in the 1990s, General Tini Groenewald, who, by the way, was the head of military intelligence, he had said the same thing to other people as well. He said it on many occasions to many people, that this guy, the guy to really worry about, is Ramaphosa. When Ramaphosa came to power, he immediately started his nonsense about the seizure of land. And I see even today, as I'm recording this, that newspapers are reporting that land seizure without compensation is back on track again, that they're about to do this thing. Land seizure also bothers me. Stealing everybody's property without compensation, that really bothers me a lot. For me, it's a reason enough to go to war. Really, it's reason enough to go to war. And in that regard, I am on a mailing list for the stupid Democratic Alliance, the liberal bastards in South Africa. The DA, the Democratic Alliance, is totally, totally owned by Jews from top to bottom. I wouldn't be surprised if 90% of the Jews in South Africa vote for the DA, and whoever doesn't vote for the DA votes for the ANC or the Communist Party. That's how Jews will vote. But the current leader of the DA, he sent out a message some months ago about this seizure of land without compensation. And it was the only time ever that I bothered to reply to the stupid DA. And I replied and I wrote to them and I said that the seizure of land without compensation is reason enough to go to war. That we should go to war over this thing. That's how seriously I view the matter. Of course, the fools never replied, but that is the way that I really feel about it. Seizing land without paying for it, as well as all these other threats to whites, these are things that really irk me, and I watch when these things come along. So once Ramaphosa came and he started with this land seizure nonsense, I then decided that it's time to say my say to as many governments as possible. And the other thing that Ramaphosa also did, and I've seen it continuously in the media, is there is talk of censorship, putting people in jail, putting whites in jail for running groups on phones, etc. And they're looking for reasons to put whites in jail. So between things that threaten the lives of whites, land seizure without compensation, and also censorship. This caused me to go on a big spree of my own to send messages to many embassies. In total, I sent messages to about 30 embassies. I wrote up everything that I'd done since the time of Zimbabwe and all the information that I'd accumulated in the time, as well as my own personal opinions. And I sent this to at least 30 countries, all of them Western countries. I sent it not only to the US and Canada, but to France, Germany, all the major countries in Europe, and also small countries in Europe. And I also included Japan. I regard Japan as the only non-white country that is friendly to whites in South Africa. The whites and the Japanese had a great relationship under apartheid, an excellent relationship, in fact. So the Japanese are the only non-whites that I would actually communicate with. And in the time of apartheid, for the record, the Japanese were classed as honorary whites. So the Japanese were regarded as whites, and the Chinese were regarded as blacks, and the Indians were regarded as blacks, which I totally agree with. The only people they didn't classify as blacks, who should have been classified as blacks, were the Jews. But in my communications, I wrote up a long document and I sent it to everybody. And in there, I openly stated that I regard the land seizure without compensation as reason enough to go to war. I also openly stated that I do not regard the ANC as my government. I regard them as hostile. I don't trust them at all in anything, etc., etc. So those are the kinds of blunt statements that I've made in my documents that I've sent off. I have not held back on anything. I've told them how I feel about things, what I think about things, and I've been absolutely blunt. I never got any communications back from anybody, but at least they have it all in writing and they know my views. And I think it's important that we also tell our views, because if we don't tell our views, who's going to speak on our behalf? Now, just some notes about communicating with governments, because this is not the same as dealing with the media. It's not the same as dealing with the corporates. With the media and the corporates, you are trying to make their lives a misery. You're trying to fuck them around, which they rightly deserve, I might add. They totally and utterly deserve everything. They deserve much more, in fact, these swines. But when you are dealing with the government, you must be polite to them. You must treat your communications as serious. You really should look at any communications with them as being the same thing as if you go to a police station, not a South African police station. I'm talking a first world police station where things actually work. You should regard any document that you write for an embassy or a foreign government, take it as seriously as if you were at a police station and you were reporting a crime and you were writing an affidavit. Take it that seriously. Look at what you're writing. Make sure that your facts are correct. At the end of the day, all Western countries and all intelligence systems operate on, among other things, the reliability of the source. You are the source of that information. If you are an unreliable source, nobody's going to take you seriously. They might listen to you when you communicate to them the first time, but if you send them rubbish and your stuff doesn't have any solid factual basis, they will just ignore you more and more. The actual message that you're trying to communicate to them will become more and more diminished if you are not accurate and serious about it. One thing that they do want is if you send them any information, then you need to tell them where you got the information from. Is it from your own personal observations? Or did you speak to somebody? Did somebody tell you? You need to tell them who you spoke to, etc. You need to supply them with your details and the details of the person or persons you spoke to. They will want to know the full name. They'll want to have some kind of contact details. an email, or better still, a telephone number for that person. You may need to tell them where that person lives. You need to do these things for yourself as well. You need to tell them who you are, what is your physical address, what is your telephone number, etc. You need to do these things. If you do these things, it will add to the seriousness and the trust of your message. If you try and write to them and you hide your name and you don't tell them where you are and you lie about this and you hide that thing over there, let me tell you, that is not going to work for you. That is just being silly. In all the years that I've communicated with governments, I have never yet had an instance where I gave someone's details and that person was even phoned by them. Like I tell you, everything is quiet, and unless there is a pressing need, that person will never even know about it. So they're not going to go and harass you. They're not going to come and knock on your door. They simply take your report, look it over, and we'll see what is in there that can be checked up on. Remember, they too have got very extensive systems of their own, and they will be feeding that information into their systems. They will also want to check things. So if you just come and say, my name is John and I heard this from Jack and, you know, I've got no further details. If you give them a whole bunch of hearsay and you don't have any seriousness, then your message is going to be diminished. And like I say, you'll probably be met with silence more than anything else. You won't even have anybody acknowledging receipt of what you've sent. But the point is, it gets to their system and it will reach somebody. Even if it's probably just a psychologist who's trying to figure out whether all the people are now psychotic or whatever. But whatever it is, your information is going to go into a system in the Western world, and that's important. And in that regard, I think it's more important to get information into their systems. Remember, there is no money changing hands. Governments don't pay money for information. But if they see they get reliable information from you, etc., they regard it as a friendly sign. They use it in that sense. And remember, no matter how screwed up things are at the top, there are lots of people inside the system who are professionals, who are normal people like you and me, and they just want to do a good job, and they are trying to be as professional about their work as possible. It's that simple. But the difference is that this is not the same as these businesses, these anti-white businesses, whose agenda is to be anti-white. Instead, you've got state machinery at work, and they're only interested in facts. They are like the police. They're only interested in facts. And if you go and you start writing to them about prophecies and religion and stuff like that, you're just going to come across as a goofball and they're not going to be very interested in what you have to say. And if you flood them with junk, that's also no good for you. But every message that's sent at least means something. And they know that they've got it from a white who's concerned in one way or another. And they will take note of these things. Never at any time have I taken information that I get and have I submitted it to the South African police or the South African government. I never, ever, ever deal with them. I don't trust them at all. I don't trust them at all. So anything that I've ever had that was important, I got it to countries outside because I do not trust this system one bit. Among the Western countries, just some thoughts. The one country I would never deal with are the British. The British are so anti-white. They've got such a long history of being anti-white. Britain is the one Western country I would never, ever communicate with in any way. But I would recommend communicating with everybody in Europe. I'd recommend communicating with any of the other Western countries, whether it's America, Canada, Australia, New Zealand. I would recommend communicating with them. With Europe especially, I would highly recommend all the countries of Europe. And I would especially say, don't just worry about the big countries. Communicate with every single European country, no matter how small. Communicate with all of them, because the small ones might even be more useful in some respects than the big ones. The big ones have got larger interests and are more likely to be, let's call it, compromised through commerce internationally than the smaller ones. So write to every country, no matter how small it is, even the tiniest, tiniest Western country in the European Union. Write to any and all of them. I myself will update my list and add some more countries to the lists because I regard the times that we are entering as important. I'm especially concerned by these things of seizing land without compensation. I'm also very concerned about ongoing threats of censorship, etc. If they stop us from talking to each other, that can be a huge problem. And things like them interfering with our phones, we can rightly claim that because the police and the system is so useless, that we use our phones mainly for survival purposes. And this is true. We use our phones in order to get crime information in our areas, and all our communications on the phones basically revolve around security. That is what we are using the phones for, because we cannot rely on the police or anybody else. And many of us pay security companies to protect us anyway and give us armed response. You know, so that is a common thing that most people do. And here the government is trying to stop us communicating. I regard the loss of communications as a very dangerous thing. If we stop having the ability to talk to each other, we got enormous problems. Any information that you have, including photographs, including copies of documents, it could be useful. Also use that. Photographs are especially useful, but anything that you have that is physical, like a written document or a photograph, something that can be checked, all these things are very important. Regard it as being the same as handing over information to a detective. Regard it as being like that. Don't expect to hear anything from anyone, but rest assured, it is being looked at. Somebody is looking at it. Another point I want to make about email communications is that it is possible using websites, and this was something that I was busy thinking about in the beginning, and I even did a little bit of this, but there weren't enough people interested at the time to take it further. But you will find that you can blast off emails from websites. Technical guys will know how to do it. And you could actually set up things so that emails go from websites or from our own servers. And you can actually flood people with emails. You could flood governments, you could flood everybody with emails. The danger with that, though, is that as the years have gone by and spam has become a bigger and bigger problem, there are rules that have been created on the internet. And these rules include a bunch of technical stuff that occurs. And I've had to learn about this for my own purposes. And basically, anything which appears to be like spam, which can be detected as coming from a single server, etc., this stuff immediately gets a lower classification in the international email system. So if you try to flood people with emails, and of course nothing stops you from sending emails even to embassies and sending emails with fake names, fake details, etc., and just flooding them in that way. The problem with doing that sort of thing is that sooner or later, either the international email systems themselves will start flagging it as spam, or sooner or later, someone at that government will figure out that this is just being blasted out to them and that they're just being spammed. And then you can rest assured you've done more damage to your cause than anything else. The way that email really works is that at the end of the day, all that these technical systems are trying to do is they're trying to determine and decide when an email comes along whether that email was genuinely sent by a human being. Everything is geared towards determining that. So if you use your phone or you use your laptop or your PC or your tablet and you send an email from that device itself and its communications with the email servers, they will then realize and recognize that this is a human being sending this email. That immediately gives the email a much higher priority, and the email does not get marked as spam. And that is excellent. So at the end of the day, it is more important to have emails coming from real live human beings. It is better to have 10 emails from 10 physical people than to send 10,000 emails that are spam, because then those 10,000 emails are going to be totally ignored. And they'll even be blocked. They'll even be stopped from getting there. They won't even get there after a time. So it is important that each email is sent by a human being. And the way your device is designed, it is designed in such a way to tell the other servers that this is a message being sent by a person. So that is really important. It's important, therefore, that people do this and that it not be automated, because automating this and just blasting out tons of stuff can actually end up in everything being ignored. Other possibilities also is to send emails to NGOs, non-governmental organizations, or to some kind of international criminal court. Personally, I do not trust NGOs. I've never found an NGO that actually was effective in any way at all. I don't regard non-governmental organizations as being pro-white. They're almost always liberal things, and in some cases, they're even funded by the CIA, and they are often even fronts for communists, liberals, Jews, and just assorted rubbish. And they don't actually have any value. I have yet to come across an NGO that actually helped me or helped anybody that I knew. What is more likely to work is something like sending a thing to an international court, like the International Court in The Hague. If there is somebody who has got some kind of legal background, even a student, and they can take something and write it up and maybe send something to the international court and try to get a court case lodged. Even just something simple like that, that gives you a case number, etc. These things could also have some kind of value, some kind of ripple effect. But other than that, I wouldn't bother with any other kinds of organizations, and definitely not NGOs. So that's as much as I can think of. I think I've covered almost every conceivable base, and I hope that this gives people some ideas of what can be done. Among the other thoughts that I would suggest is that whites in any country can write to the embassies of any other country. It's not just that whites in South Africa need to write to embassies. Whites in other countries can write to embassies. Whites in other countries could even write to the South African embassies. Not that I think that they'll actually do much. Might scare them if they start getting emails that come from angry people. That would be interesting. But I think it's much more effective to send emails to Western countries. And I'd even suggest to people that maybe whites should consider sending messages to other countries, like, for example, take the Germans, where the Germans are chucking all kinds of German people in jail just for questioning the Holocaust or mentioning the word Jew. What if people tell the German government, that we think it is very unfair that they are chucking Germans in jail who are merely questioning historical facts and are doing serious research? That why can't these people be allowed to speak their mind? Why must they end up in jail? I think it might shock the German government, or at least affect people at the lower ranks, if they were to realize that other people actually are sort of on their side, that they don't want to see other whites just being thrown in jail willy-nilly. That just because Jews hate Germans doesn't mean that everybody else hates Germans. In fact, When Jews hate somebody, you must know that they're good people. I do think that silence is the worst thing of all that whites can engage in. There's a lot of fear out there, and if some people can take some steps, do what you can. I just want to discuss the moves by President Ramaphosa to seize land, seize farmland without compensation. Because to me, this is an enormous project. And this is a project that can really screw it up for all the whites of South Africa. And this is something that is so radical and so dangerous. This brings us right back to Robert Mugabe just seizing farms one after the other and totally destroying the whites. In South Africa, the ANC, the ruling party, have already laid the groundwork a long time ago to really smash the whites. They already put laws in place in the 1990s that were such that they already had the legal means to come after whites in all sorts of ways. One of the things that I discovered, for example, was to do with mineral rights. The government secretly went and basically stole mineral rights from everybody. They actually made it such that if you dig deeper than 6 feet in the ground, that you are basically trespassing on government property. When I mentioned this to some Americans, one American then said to me, if you have a basement, which we don't really have in South Africa, but if you were to have a basement in your house, you'd already be ending up on government territory. And that's correct. They created many laws that were preparatory laws for bigger and nastier things. Like I say, one of them being mineral rights. And this seizing of farms is most likely in order to seize farms that they can hand over to mining companies. Now, the radicalism and communism and anti-white hatred of the ANC does come out every now and then. And all of the different presidents, Mandela, Mbeki, Zuma, Ramaphosa, each and every one of them has, in his own way, shown his hostility to whites. Even though you'll find that it's only liberals and Jews who hated Zuma. But all of them are evil. And Ramaphosa might even be the most evil of the lot. But he is hamstrung by other problems, which might actually help to prevent him doing all that he wants to do. But these people have already passed laws, and they just haven't gone and forced these things down our throats. But they can do that at any time. This notion of stealing the farmland, despite all the reasons given for it, these people actually have a maliciousness about them, and they actually want to destroy and harm whites. When I wrote my book, Government by Deception, I went to great lengths to try and explain that. That when these blacks claim that they need to solve a problem in a certain way, that's not actually true. They also look at other things, and they, for example, do not want to see us progressing forward. They will therefore do things to harm us, and they'll do things to harm us simply so that we cannot move forward. They have the viewpoint that communists have, that if they can't have something, then they'll deny it to you. They will rather have South Africa burned to the ground than have you grow stronger because you might threaten them. That is the way that they think. And if you look carefully, you'll see that when they make certain moves, they word it and angle it so that it causes harm and discomfort to whites deliberately, even though it doesn't really need to be that way. At the end of the day, they are our enemies. These were the worst of our enemies, and they remain our enemies. But now they're our government. and we don't control their electoral base. We are on the menu, and they can spend all their time beating up on us, blaming us for stuff, because we aren't their voter base, and they can direct their anger at us always, regardless of the fact that we aren't the cause of their problems. And they, of course, in their politics, in their malicious politics, they will never admit to themselves being the cause of their own problems. I personally do not see anything to be gained from trying to befriend them and convincing them otherwise. This has been going on for a very long time, and ultimately we have to clash with them. Any other strategy merely wastes time and achieves nothing for us. But their most dangerous move in recent times has been this talk of seizing land. And this land that they want to seize, and the law that they wrote, I've spoken to some people who've studied those laws, and those laws are actually hideous. Although they claim that the reason for this is to seize farmland, and of course, as always, they claim that blacks need land, that blacks want to farm. All these things are lies. Blacks don't want to farm. Blacks aren't interested in farming. This is about seizing property from the whites. Now, they could seize that property and pay for it, but they've gone to tremendous lengths to give bogus reasons as to why they don't want to pay for it. And my view is simply that the reason they don't want to pay for it has got nothing to do with whether they can afford it or not. It is simply that they deliberately want to harm the people whose land they are taking. They want to take somebody's property away as a way of punishing that person. Either that, or the property is so valuable that they want to give it to their buddies. And one of these two reasons will be driving their decisions. And I don't think it'll always be just the one reason. I think it depends on what it is that they want. The first farm that they tried to get hold of was a farm that had huge coal reserves, and that was the main reason they went after it. Because they want to take these farms, and I think the bottom line is they just want to farm it out to their buddies, and they're going to all make huge amounts of money out of mining. I actually think that the blacks, in the long, long term, will probably only function on mining in Africa. I think that this is where the blacks are heading as a whole, because nothing else is working for them. And in the end, they'll just have to sell the resources in the ground to whomever is the highest bidder. And that is how these blacks are going to survive in the future. They themselves are not capable of creating industry or anything else, and their leaders know it. But they'll never say it in public, and in public, the game is always bash the white man. Now, I want to talk about this because I just want to talk about this problem with relation to pressure and why they haven't done this yet. When Ramaphosa came up with this notion that this thing must be, as he said, fast-tracked, I seem to recall that he set a date, and the date he set was for March 2019. I think this came out of the conference at the end of 2018, the ANC annual conference, and Ramaphosa said that this needs to be fast-tracked at the soonest. And the date that he set for it was March 2019, because there was the election in May 2019. At the time, due to my own preparations to go to the USA, I didn't follow it that closely. But I was very surprised when suddenly the whole issue seemed to disappear. Now, the farming organizations represent the farmers, and there are quite a few of them. And these farming organizations are generally quite well funded by the farmers, and they have got quite sophisticated methods of dealing with things. and they hire attorneys and they do various things. They also do their own activism as well to various official bodies outside South Africa and inside South Africa. So it seemed to me that the pressure of various groups may actually have stopped the ANC last year, because it was not only the farming groups that were really upset, but there were others too. And maybe with different people in different positions and different organizations, including possibly AfriForum, etc., they may well have created such a stink about it that possibly, the Western world also put pressure on the ANC. And since we don't know the internals, we don't know for sure why this thing mysteriously stopped last year. And then it was revived a bit again later, and then it also didn't go anywhere. But I suspect that this is an example of how pressure applied from different sides might even help trigger the Western world, and the Western world itself will also come and try to do things. Like I say, the Western world isn't going to threaten the ANC with this and that, but they will, in their very polite way, they will say to the blacks, "Is this really necessary?" etc. The British themselves had actually given the ANC money to go ahead with this. The filthy British always pandering to black communists. The British, who are controlled by the Jews, have no shame whatsoever. But in gentle ways, economic threats and suggestions can be made by the West, which can make life more difficult for the ANC. So exactly what the reasons are why Ramaphosa's big move has been held up, that is interesting. And I suspect that it has to do with some of the heat that came from different sides. And I regard it as a successful thing. And I just wanted to point this out to people that this is how things can work if one does one's activism properly and you have some kind of success. Another nasty thing that they've also spoken about is about seizing pension funds, seizing everybody's pension funds. That's also nasty, nasty stuff. And just returning to this land seizure without compensation, it's not just about seizing farmland. 70% of the land claims are actually on properties in cities. They could even seize your house if you live in a city. And somebody who's actually studied the actual law told me that the law, just like that law to do with mineral rights, that the law is so broadly written that the ANC can literally steal anything that you own. They can come, they can even take your car. They can not just take your farm, they can take your house in the town, they can take your business, they can take any property you own, including things like cars, intellectual property, etc. If the government decides so, they can come and steal everything from you. Nobody is actually safe. That's how dangerous this law is. They can come and seize a suburb if they wanted to. That's how nasty this thing is. In the earlier days of ANC rule, they used to float many ideas. And I think there were some ideas they floated as trial balloons in order to see how people reacted to them. They came up with all kinds of nasty ideas. Then they'd put it in the newspapers and they'd make public statements about it. And then, very quietly, those ideas disappear. And I suspect that on many occasions, the ANC would have done crazy, crazy things if it wasn't that there was some kind of pushback that came at them. And they also have to be careful that they don't trigger bigger things. But I think the blacks are also getting so desperate that their own politics can fall apart if they don't do some of these things. You must know that these blacks have campaigned for decades on the basis that the white man has stolen from them, that all their problems are related to white people, that white people are the root of all evil for them. And therefore, the solution, the communist solution, as always, is steal from the white man. You are suffering, and you're suffering because of the white man. Now, the answer is steal from the white man. It's not known as stealing. The white man stole from you first. You're just taking back what is rightfully yours. That is their angle of attack. I think that many whites who are not politically savvy and politically conscious have, over the years, just assumed that the ANC does the right thing, that the ANC is reasonable, that the ANC won't do crazy stuff. What they aren't aware of are the quiet pressures, both internationally and also internally in the country, that have stopped the ANC from doing wild, wild things that would have destroyed us. But this land seizure thing, this is a big thing, and I regard this as a huge threat to us. I would say, other than an outright military attack on whites, that is the thing that worries me the most. They can come and steal all your stuff. Now, it must be said that many whites in South Africa are also doing a good job when they're involved in some of these things, because people who are involved with some of these legal things, they come along and then they make suggestions to the government that help to take the sheer madness and lunacy of these black maniacal communists. And they come and they make suggestions on how these laws can be implemented in a way that is reasonable. So they come and they put in what you could call roadblocks in the law to say, well, yes, you can seize land, but you have to have this condition, that condition, etc. They try to come up with ideas that prevent this thing from being totally abused, which is what the ANC is out to do. They are out to abuse the law. They are out to fuck up the whites. But other whites manage to trip it up through some kind of professionalism and reasonableness, and in various meetings and feedback sessions, they try to put some pressure or come up with clever ideas to stop the ANC doing the wild fucking communist shit that these motherfuckers are actually dreaming of and having wet dreams over. But I think it's important for people who are thinking about activism to also realize that other people are also playing some roles. Other whites are playing roles that you might not be realizing. And also to give you another example of how the West at times has stopped the ANC and prevented them in certain things. Not that it happens often, but to give you an example, one thing that I came across a long time ago was the fact that South Africa had nuclear weapons and we had 6 nuclear bombs. And the CIA, the American CIA, deliberately said and stated that the ANC must not be allowed to have nuclear weapons. And that is the real reason why F.W. de Klerk went, the president of the time went, and they dismantled all the nuclear weapons and destroyed everything. They did it because that was one of the CIA's conditions, that when South Africa goes under black rule, that they must not let these communist, Soviet-loving, Chinese-loving blacks have access to nuclear weapons. So there are some things that do work. The only problem is that for us, there are things that are of a much smaller scale, but they are directly threatening to our existence. So what I'm trying to sketch is just that it's not like the ANC is a totally unstoppable organism. There are things that have tripped it up, there are things that have slowed it down, there are things that have made it more difficult for them. They do have a policy where they have to consult groups around the country when they're busy with major changes. I don't know fully how this thing came into being, but it's actually quite a clever mechanism, and thank goodness for this, because this has probably stopped us on dozens of occasions from going straight over the cliff. But ultimately, these blacks, and even the general politics that's unfolding in South Africa, if you look carefully at it, you will see that we are moving ever more away from liberalism. And the ANC itself has been getting rid even of Jews, even of Indians, etc. The ANC is mutating ever more into a totally black organization. And this means that they will only be concerned with black politics. They're not going to be interested in other people. And the whole liberal theme that was created falsely around the ANC, that theme is falling apart. They are going down a firm, firm blacks-only road. And when you go down that path will bring them into direct confrontation with whites. And stuff like this land stuff, etc., this stuff can become a big thing. For me personally, this worries me more than anything else. And I would urge people that as part of any kind of activism, that this land seizure stuff, without compensation, this thing needs to be on everybody's agenda when they are doing activism. This is a very, very dangerous thing. Using this, they can totally destroy us. And I assure you that when they go after this, apart from farmers, where the farmers got specifically rich land that's got lots of minerals on it, the other thing that the ANC will do, which the blacks have done in Zimbabwe, etc., is they will use bogus reasons to come and seize the property of anybody whom they determine is an enemy of their organization. They will use bogus reasons to destroy any farmers and any businessmen and any people who they see as an actual threat to their organization. In Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe's Central Intelligence Organization drew up lists of farmers and prioritized who needs to be deprived of their land at the soonest. They did it according to the threat value of that person. And that is why some farmers were able to stay on and to retain their lands, because they were total sellouts. They were willing to do anything the government wanted. They were a bunch of lapdogs, etc. This is how these communists think, and you've got to be aware of it. They are dangerous, and they are malicious, and they are constantly looking for ways to abuse their power. Luckily, South Africa is very high profile in certain respects, and so there is a lot more focus on it. But we mustn't take these things for granted. These bastards can come up with something, and if they ram something through and try to actually push something forward, we could have big trouble here. And so we need to be vigilant at all times. watching all the moves that they're making and trying to counter it and trying to bugger it up for them. For them, in the long term, they have to go with black politics because that's where the numbers are. That's what means something to them. And those blacks are crazy. And crazier blacks are talking about wilder and wilder things. And that is what we've got to be careful of. And we need to try and head this stuff off at the soonest. And we need to keep our eyes open for other nefarious ideas that they're busy hatching. And nowadays, the Jews are very close to Ramaphosa. Very, very close. His best buddy is the chief rabbi of South Africa. Their friendship is reason for serious concern. The more we leave it alone, the worse it's going to get. And everybody's got to try and do something for somebody else. We really must try and see internationally what can we do in support of each other. Honestly, I don't see any other hope for us. The only true hope that exists for us is from other common whites. And the key here is other common white people. Later on, I'll return to the topic of people who've got money, people who are rich, and why common white people is really what we should be focusing on. For us in South Africa especially, the only true friends that we have are other common white people. But I think, generally speaking, you will all find that this is really the case. The only whites who will stand by the Germans are other common white people. The only whites who will stand by Americans, true Americans, will be other common white people. At the end of the day, this is going to be about whites standing with whites and helping each other. I think this is the only way that any real change can come about. This is the only hope that there really is. But huge things can come from this if we can stick together as a team and do our teamwork. So I think I've touched on every base that I can think of, and I hope that it gives people some ideas, and feel free to experiment and test out things as best you can. But this is the most comprehensive stuff that I could think of, and I hope that it gives people some ideas of what's going on out there. Not everything is quite as bad as you think. And I think that if certain things weren't done, things would have been much, much worse than they are now. But I hope this has been of help to somebody. It is a topic that, if necessary, we can revisit again. But I thought I'd cram as much into this topic as is possible to give you some thoughts of how to deal with this. And like many things, the next step is that people must do stuff, people must try stuff, and we must see what we can come up with. These are my websites, historyreview.com, africancrisis.info, and white-shop.biz. This is my attempt to try and do some Jew-free trading and experimenting with the next level of stuff. So, thank you very much for listening. We'll be chatting again soon. Take care of yourselves.